using free speech to free minds. You're listening to The David Knight Show.
As the clock strikes 13, it's Friday, the 1st of October, year of our Lord 2021, day 566 of America held hostage of the New World Orders. And so today we're going to take a look at updates, the fights against the mandates, how people are organizing and fighting back against that. But we're also going to take a look at some Second Amendment news, as well as the toxic medicine, what is happening at the border. Many topics coming up. Stay with us. We'll be right back. As we are moving into October, October the 1st is a deadline for many. We have seen, isn't it interesting, around the world how they are synced up on this. It's interesting how quickly things are developing, and it's interesting how quickly they are synchronized from the U.S. to Australia to other places as they impose these mandates from about the middle of September to the beginning of October in most cases. They're all doing exactly the same thing. It makes absolutely no difference what political party they are a part of. It really doesn't. So we look at this, and I've got a letter that I want to get to from an individual who had questions about whether or not this is Marxism or not. Look, a lot of these labels that are being applied by the politicians really don't apply anymore. I mean, they're really there for the most part to try to get people to move into different groups that they identify with. You know, when you vote for these politicians, do they really do what they said they were going to do? The philosophies that they identify with, the policies that they take, that's just part of getting you to vote for them. And you can certainly see this around the world. As I've said many times, it doesn't matter whether the party identifies as conservative, as what we would call libertarian in the United States, or in other places, they would call that the Liberal Party. It's confusing, I know, for Americans to understand that. That has been so ingrained in us because we use their terminology. But yeah, liberal used to mean that you're about liberty. Imagine that. But it doesn't matter what the labels are. As a matter of fact, old Gladys Berejiklian has now resigned. Not for anything that she's done in terms of killing people, in terms of killing society. Just like Cuomo, she was able to do whatever she wanted until you had some, shall we say, affair. It was just, in her case, it was one. yes, have you seen a picture of Gladys? She actually had an affair with some. You must be crawling under a rock at this point in time. This stern person. Who made her case in point that her whole life was politics. And she was there to make sure that she was going to lead you. And she was sacrificing her life. She was going to have no one else in her life, no children. And it was all going to be about her job. You know, that just like Hillary Clinton, the politics of meaning. Politics gives meaning to her life. Turns out she had something on the side. So she's now resigned in disgrace, just like Cuomo. But it is no disgrace to murder people. It is no disgrace to turn your country into a police state. No, that's fine. Just stay there. We'll find another police state dictator. But, oh, don't violate these rules that we have for the woke crowd here. This is, I want to talk about the mandated Trump shots first. And this is from a listener, Richard. And he sent me the job offer, and it was a very good job offer that he had, working as HVAC, an engineer in a facility. He said, check out this job offer. He said he and the employer signed it last night, and then they illegally rescinded it today after I told them that I have antibodies and a religious exemption, so I wasn't interested in being vaccinated. They told me that even though the White House had said that they're supposed to offer testing instead, they said they're not going to. Literally, the government was instituted for the sole purpose of protecting our rights, and they do nothing but the opposite. I guess the full Antichrist system is here. Even though we're living in Texas, I literally can't work because I won't say that Caesar is Lord and take their injection. And so that is exactly what we're looking at. You know, when we talk about the border and we talk about this false accusation about the border agents whipping people with, you know, the on horseback, I didn't buy that. I mean, I you know, played the clip from the news media, and even the news media at the time, CNN, was saying, well, this is what they say, that they're hitting people with whips, but then they say that they're not, they're just moving the horses around and so forth. Look, the border agents are there. These people are, you know, as as we'd say, they do not bear the reins of power in vain. Right. If you're going to try to force your way into a country, they might bump you with their horse. The horse might step on your foot, or you might get slapped with some reins. But it turns out that was all fiction. And even the New York Times has pointed that out. And yet, as this was rolling through, you had Greg Abbott say, well, if these border agents are fired by the federal government, by Biden, we'll hire them here in Texas. And I said that was virtue signaling. And it really was. Look, if Abbott wanted to do something, one of the things that he could do to push back against Biden, which would be a very effective strategy, wouldn't it, to push back against Biden, would be to hire these nurses or people who work for the federal government, the military, give them jobs in Texas. Make Texas a freedom zone, freedom from vaccine coercion, vaccine mandates. Wouldn't that be a good thing to do? I mean, it's working out pretty good for DeSantis. I understand that DeSantis is not perfect. I understand he is a vaccine cheerleader. I understand he's pushing Regeneron, the monoclonal antibody. And I think that that has many issues, both medically and ethically. But look, when they do the right thing, you need to applaud them, because you're not applauding them. You're not applauding a man. You know, if you criticize them when they do the wrong thing and you applaud them when they do the right thing, you're applauding the policy, and you make that clear. And when the right policy is in effect, you need to applaud that. You need to speak up and say, yes, and we need other people to stand up and do that. But here in Texas, the Republican governor and the Republican legislature have, as we have seen in most of these states, merely posed or been completely silent. And so while he will do all kinds of photo ops, he'll have a bunch of state troopers drive their cars down to the border and put them in a line and take a picture of them, while he'll offer to give jobs to the Border Patrol agents who are being falsely accused by Biden, he won't do anything to stop these vaccine mandates or passports that are being rolled out by Biden. Not a thing is being done. Not a thing. It was in Houston, one of the first big cases of nurses being fired. Crickets from Abbott and the rest of these people. He is in on this. He's been in on this from day zero, actually from as soon as Trump released the massive amounts of money to the governors. He spent $300 million on contact tracing in a very suspicious company. Media left and right were questioning, what in the world? Who is this company? And why is he spending $300 million? You know, he talked about, I'm going to spend, what was it, $250 million to protect the border, something like that. It was less than he was decided he was going to spend on contact tracing at the very beginning of this. It was always, the contact tracing was always about the passports. It was always about the vaccine mandates. He is a wolf in sheep's clothing, and most of these Republican governors are. And even if DeSantis is a wolf in sheep's clothing, you applaud him when the wolf does the right thing. And then when understand that you don't turn your back on them, because they will, these guys will jump on you when you're not looking. New poll finds lingering sharp political divisions on the Biden vaccine mandate. And not only are there apparently sharp political divisions, but there's sharp polling divisions as well. If you look at the political poll that was put out on the by The Hill, leftist establishment organization, the poll was funded by the Associated Press. And then I can look at another poll that was done by the Trafalgar Group and the Convention of States Action, which is a conservative polling organization and a conservative group that is funding that. And guess what? You get completely different poll results. As we've seen with these elections over the various years, do you really believe any of these poll results? You know that they can rig the numbers. Yeah, I got the numbers here, right? Look at this. I got cases. I got they rig numbers up one side and down the other. We know that from looking at unemployment figures, at inflation figures. You know, if inflation is looking bad, you just throw out the things that are going up the fastest so that you can look good. For the unemployment numbers, they will put out rosy. They ignore a lot of things to deflate the unemployment figures in the first place. And then it gets even worse for the unemployment figures. They revise them the next quarter. So the next quarter, what they do is they revise up the previous quarter so they can make it look like there's a downward trend in unemployment. Every administration does that. They do that every quarter. And so when we look at the polling numbers, what do? Well, they don't tell you. And the polling data, they will tell you how many, what percentage of Republicans said this and what percentage of Democrats did that. But they don't tell you what percentage of Republicans and Democrats they polled. Not in the articles, anyway. I mean, if you can go back and get to the organization itself, sometimes you can get to the data. Sometimes you have to be a paid subscriber to them to get to the data. But most of the time, they don't tell you that. You know, when you have the exit polls with the elections, and I've said this many times, with all of the talk about what happened this last election, the dog that is not barked is the exit polling information. We have, just as we have a press pool in this country, and, you know, they don't have every single news organization, for example, cover the White House at a particular time. I mean, they have a limited number of people who are allowed to do it. And that's a little cabal. It's actually called a guild, I think. But it's a little, the White House Press Association is a club, and I ain't in it. I'm not even interested in, the last thing in the world I would want to do is be in Washington. But the when you look at the way they control the access to information with these pools, right? They have a pool. So they have somebody who represents them at a lot of these events, and then everybody shares in the press pool. They might have a video feed that they share with people, so they don't have a gazillion cameras all in one place. So they minimize it a little bit that way. For the exit polling, there's one organization that does exit polling nationwide. Even though it's reported and reported in different ways by the different media organizations, there's just one organization that does exit polling. And the government understands that exit polling is a very important way to understand whether an election has been rigged or not. And when they look at whether or not they think an election has been rigged by the government, what the U.S. State Department has set up a long time ago is to look at the difference between the exit polls and the reported numbers. And if they see more than a 5% difference between those two, they believe somebody's stuffing the ballot one way or the other. Have you seen anybody look at that number in this last election? I haven't. One of the problems is when they report what is happening with the exit polls, they never report the vote totals. You'll get every kind of demographic cross-tabulation that you can imagine. this is how many women voted for candidate A, and this is how many voted for candidate B, and this is how many men, and this is how many women in the suburbs voted for this, and this is how many white women voted for this candidate, how many black women voted for this candidate, that type of thing. They go down and they get every possible demographic combination, and they start playing these games just like this poll is doing about the vaccinated versus the unvaccinated. But you know what they don't tell you? They don't say, well, in this particular state, candidate A had this percentage of the vote based on exit polling, and candidate B had that percentage, because then you would look at that, and if it was more than 5% off from the reported totals, you would know they're playing the game. And the fact that they don't report it, and the fact that the mainstream press does not question that or report it, tells you that they've been playing this game for a long time. This is not the first corrupt election that we've had. This has been going on for a very long time. They know exactly how to do a quick audit on the integrity of the election, and they don't do it. So when we look at these two polls, for example, the Associated Press, as reported by The Hill, has one set of numbers, and then the Convention of States Action Trafalgar Group, as reported by Breitbart, has a different set. So according to the liberals, they say that you have 51% of the people that they polled in a national poll agree with Biden on the vaccine mandates. They say 51% want vaccine mandates, 34% do not. Whereas with the conservative group, it goes exactly the other way. They say 22% approve of this and 65% disapprove of the vaccine mandates. This is science, right? It's science. We got the numbers right here to prove it. Even on the AP poll, when they break it down by political parties, they say Democrats, 77% of Democrats approve. Only 11% disapprove of the mandates. Republicans, 62% disapproved and 27% approved, and they said it was about equal, with independents 37 to 35. So again, who knows, right? We know what is right. We know what we're going to do, and we know where this all leads. As Dinesh D'Souza points out, he grew up in India, and caste systems are not merely unjust, they're also ugly to behold. Commenting to me once on India's caste system when I was a child, my father said, people in this country still use the word untouchable, which is, if you think about it, a very unlovely term. And Dinesh D'Souza says, while India's caste system persists despite being outlawed, America traditionally has not had a caste system until now. He said, we can see it emerging right here in America, a sharp divide between progressive elites and ordinary citizens. Progressive elites, for example, have walls to protect their homes, even as they declare that walls don't work. They have private security, even as they insist Americans don't need guns to protect themselves. They somehow elude accountability, even when they break the same laws that ordinary citizens get into trouble for. But when it comes to the prop-ademic, that's what I think maybe we should start calling it. I think it's a good name. You know, Plandemic was a good name. It was planned. But prop-ademic, this is kind of like a prop. It's acting, and it's also propaganda, the prop-ademic. When it comes to the prop-ademic, you can see as they're creating an apartheid. This is a hashtag that you see all the time. No vaccine apartheid. That is the system that they're pushing for. And that's what they're bragging about in Australia. Saying, even when we get to our imaginary herd immunity, 70%, 80%, whatever it is, the people vaccinated, that gives them their herd immunity. Even when we get there, we will never let you out of your lockdown jail. We'll never let you out of house arrest. Now, that just doesn't make any sense. Unless you believe that these people are lying, that they had an agenda to vaccinate everybody from the very beginning, which is really what the case is. He goes on to say, as he's talking about this caste system and how everything is stratified, he says, we're all equally children of God. It follows from this that God loves us equally. Therefore, there is an equal dignity in persons. that derives ultimately from the fact that they are created by a transcendent God. And that's what the Declaration of Independence, what this country was always about. We are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, we all have that equality of being created in the image of God, and we should have equal opportunity. God does not create us with equal skills. Some people have gifts for one thing, other people have gifts for other things. There's different types of intelligence even. Some people have an intelligence that works for academic type of things. Other people do very poorly in academics, but they are master mechanics or something like that. I've seen that. Anybody of any age has seen that in their life. I especially seen that in engineering. A lot of people who did excellent in school really were pretty useless when it came to practical stuff. Some of that is what you work with, but some of that is your aptitude, and it's a difference in different people. But I guess growing up, what I would see, you know, Dinesh D'Souza saw the Indian caste system, and I've said many times that the intention is to make the unvaccinated untouchables, as in the Indian caste system. Growing up, it was not like that in Tampa, back in the middle of the 20th century. We knew billionaires. We knew millionaires. We knew a lot of middle-class businessmen, and they really weren't that different. One of the people that we went to church with was very, very, very wealthy. He had a chain of stores nationally, and you would have never known that he was any different from anybody else. He's one of these guys like Sam Walton, who'd ride around in a pickup truck. He would buy cars more frequently and more expensive cars than other people, but the house that he lived in and the way that he interacted with people was no different whatsoever. You might notice that one day he buys a brand new Mercedes, which is more than our house was worth. But, you know, he drove it for a couple of weeks and he says, you know, I really don't like this. The suspension's a little bit too hard and taut. I like the soft ride, so he gets rid of it and buys a Chevy. Whatever. He was no different. He just had more money. My dad grew up with a guy that had a chain of grocery stores in Florida. I went to school with his daughter. They were no different, except that they had the bigger business. And as he points out here, but you know, when I went, I'll just say that because I started thinking about that. Sorry for the digression here. But you know, when I went to New York for the first time with Karen, because she's from New York, went to New York City, that was when I first saw people who were very, very wealthy who flaunted it and who lived separate and apart from the rest of the people. When I went to New York, to the big city, it was very clear right away to me that there was a stratification. There were a lot of very, very poor people and a lot of very, very rich people who flaunted it. And there was no middle class around the city, especially. And not much of a of the middle class even outside, directly outside of the city. As Dinesh D'Souza says, how does this equal dignity play out in American life? It simply means that someone, say Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates, might have more money than you or me, but they're not better than you or me. In America, we have maids, but we don't have servants. In many restaurants, we call the waiter sir, as if he were a knight. The political philosopher Irving Kristol once said, there's no restaurant in America to which a CEO could go in the absolute assurance that he would not find the secretary dining there. That's disappearing rapidly. In this article, he talks about, as many people have, the disgusting display that you've seen at the Met Gala, at the Emmys and so forth, where you see the people who are waiters and servants having to wear masks, and these elites not having to wear it. It bothers me to go into a restaurant and have the people who are wearing, because we did that for a celebration a couple of weeks ago, and it bothers me to go into a restaurant where nobody's wearing a mask except for the people who are waiting tables. That's wrong. That's just wrong. It bothers me. They have to wear masks to work, and it bothers me, that kind of separation. So the Declaration of Independence affirms a social equality that is the very antithesis of the caste system that is being put in today. As Dinesh D'Souza says, it's unlovely, it's downright ugly, it's also immoral, and it's un-American. So you have 200 Minnesota healthcare workers suing over the vaccine mandate. Again, where are Republicans stepping up? Step up. Say, we're not going to allow that to be done in this state. We're not going to allow people to be kicked out as customers out of the public square. And, oh, by the way, we'll hire all of you nurses or find you jobs or find something here because they can come here and work without a mask. You're talking about people who held the hand of a person dying of COVID, said a lawyer who filed the case. And in an interview with Minnesota Public Radio, he said these folks risked their lives to help these patients, and now they're being terminated because of their religious beliefs. It's really sad. Troops are moving to have lawsuits and to block the Pentagon. There is a lawsuit that has been filed by two individuals, one of them an Army Staff Sergeant, the other a Marine Corps Staff Sergeant. They want the Pentagon to create a vaccine exemption for those who have been previously infected and have recovered and who have, therefore, natural immunity that lasts. They argue that the Defense Department's vaccine mandate, quote, is an open violation, unquote, of the rights of service members and is unconstitutional. It's also unscientific. There's absolutely no reason for it. If you've had a disease that you don't need to be vaccinated for it again, and it is not a vaccine at all. It's not anything at all like the other vaccines. I mean, there's just so many things that are wrong about this. But the key thing that is wrong about this is how obsessive these people are that we all get vaccinated. We all do it at the same time. That doesn't raise any questions with you. A U.S. judge, however, has now had the first case where somebody ruled on whether or not natural immunity could be used. This is a challenge by a professor at the University of California. And he said, I've had this, I've got natural immunity, and I shouldn't be required to get this. The other part of this, of course, as we all know, and we're going to be talking about that here in a second, you're seeing in country after country, as they start to ramp up the vaccine, especially in a lot of these countries where they didn't have it at first, they used other forms of treatment, nothing was happening. All of a sudden, they start vaccinating, and it goes up by a factor of 20 times more people in the hospital as soon as they start the vaccines. It goes straight up. And we have seen this in one country after the other. So first of all, it is not helping you. You could say that it is making you more vulnerable. You could say that you're being injected, perhaps, which is my opinion, you're being injected with a toxin. You're not being injected with something that is weakened or dead so that your body, your immune system, can be trained. That's the whole point, they say, of a vaccine injection. No, you're being injected with something that is itself the key thing that is toxic. What a surprise, then, that we see these types of results. But it also doesn't have anything to do with transmitting anything. They find that the viral load is the same or greater for people who have been vaccinated than it is for unvaccinated people. So there is no person-to-person reason for doing this either. It should be your own personal choice. Australia's corporations, however, are now starting to rebel against the government's draconian COVID lockdowns. This is interesting because these are some very big corporations, which you would expect, as we've seen consistently through this. You see the biggest corporations jump into this technocratic tyranny. But in Australia, you've got BHP, I think it's pronounced mockery. I don't know what that is. And Qantas, the airline, some of Australia's biggest companies have put together. They employ almost a million Australians. And these companies, the company signed a letter and said that it's time to learn to live with the virus, as other countries have done. They said COVID zero, the idea that we're going to keep everybody locked down until there's not a single case. Remember where that you first heard that? You first heard that from Fauci, the guy who has been sitting in the on the throne of the world for the last year. He was the first one who said, well, not until you don't have a single case. I was like, what in the world is he talking about? But, of course, COVID zero has been imposed as an impossible dream. Yeah, so it's left the economy hobbled and its people cut off from the rest of the world. Yeah, we have an impossible dream, don't we? That we're going to get our country back and we're going to have liberty and the rule of law again. And when I saw that phrase, it made me think of the song from The Man of La Mancha. I always loved the lyrics. To right the unrightable wrong. That's what we're going to do. No matter what it takes, we have to have that mindset. To try when your arms are too weary, no matter how hopeless, no matter how far. These signatories allege that Australia is making, quote, big mistakes in failing to reopen the world. By making the lockdown so severe, so unceasingly long, the Australian government is putting politics before the well-being of the Australian people ahead of the federal elections that must be held by the end of May when the Senate's present term is slated to expire. That's commentary by Zero Hedge. But the letter said, again, these companies that employ a million Australians, they warn that lockdowns are having long-lasting effects on the economy. You think? These are economic sanctions. I've said this from the very beginning. As soon as we started having these lockdowns, as soon as we had all this stuff, well, non-essential businesses are going to be kicked to the curb. We're going to take the life's work and investment of time and money of these small businesses, and we're just going to trample that. And I said, you know what this is? This is war. This is economic sanctions. If you go to war with a people, you would typically begin by a siege, right? You would surround the city, and you'd try to starve them out. The way that is done in the 21st century and the 20th century as well is you start with economic sanctions. Economic sanctions are an act of war. It's intended to isolate and to attack the country economically, and it is meant also to provoke the country that has been isolated, that has been surrounded, that has been cut off. It's intended to provoke them to attack first, so you can then say, well, see, they're aggressive, and now we're justified in terms of wiping them out. That's why we must not take the bait. That's why we must not. So you have a good editorial here from Brandon Smith. He really gets it. And he said, all it takes is for just one free place to change the dynamic between the public and an authoritarian regime, just one. This is why I look at the situation with DeSantis, and yes, he's not perfect. He's pushing these jabs and other things like that. And when they have pushed back on some of the free speech issues, it's primarily been to protect politicians. And a couple of years ago, he was telling people you couldn't criticize Israel, a foreign government, made that a crime. So it's a bit suspicious, but when they move in the right direction, not just a bit suspicious, it is suspicious. But when they move in the right direction, you applaud that particular move, not the person. It's important because they need to see that we agree with that, because these other people are going to be pushing back on them when they do the right thing, so you better support them when they do the right thing, number one. Number two, they make that kind of calculation. A calculating politician will look at something like this and say, well, everybody else is doing this, and that's where they want me to go, and they're putting pressure on me to do that. But I'm kind of thinking that if I go with the 80% of the people who want this, that might be, since nobody else is doing it, that might be the way to go. It's kind of like Fox News. Rupert Murdoch is not a conservative by any means. He's a statist. And yet he created a conservative news organization simply because there weren't any. And then when he went to talk radio, he decided that since talk radio was predominantly conservative, he would go the other direction. And so sometimes you can have a politician who will do, just because it is kind of a gamble, that they were going to take the path that's not being taken by anybody else. And so we need to support them when they do that. Brandon Smith says, remember when they all said that they were never going to demand forced vaccinations, that the passports were a conspiracy theory. Well, guess what? Conspiracy theorists were right again. It used to be that we would predict a particular agenda or an event, and it would take a couple of years to unfold. But these days, we make predictions, and all it takes is just a few weeks or a few months for that to happen. Now, here's the key point. This suggests to me that the establishment and the globalists are on a specific timeline, and that for whatever reason, they must get 100% vaccination. They are on a specific timeline. They want to have their new society, their new Great Reset, their new UN 2030 agenda for sustainability, their smart cities locking us down, imprisoning us in those technocratic hellholes. They want that all done by 2030. But they have very specific objectives, and you can see this when you see the way that they have moved in unison. And just as I was saying at the beginning of the program, here we are, you know, between the middle of September and the beginning of October, everybody in all these different countries in Europe and the U.S. and Australia, they're rolling out these mandates saying that you're not going to have a life if you don't get vaccinated by this time. And they started talking about that a month ago, 2 months ago, 3 months ago in France, other places. What kind of a pandemic is this if you don't have to do anything about it for another 2 or 3 months? It's not. It's simply a political plan. If this was an emergency, then all these unvaccinated nurses would have been killing everybody all the time, right? No, they're going in lockstep. Do you remember I talked about the Rockefeller Foundation about a decade ago? They had a scenario, four different ways that things could go. And the two, you know, when you've got two different variables, you can wind up with a combination of four things. And so what they did was they came up with four scenarios. And the two variables were how the government was going to act and how the people were going to act. And so, you know, you had a situation where both the government is being very open about things and the people are being very active in terms of what they're doing. I guess many people look at that as the best case scenario. But the worst case scenario was what they called lockstep. You've heard that a lot. A lot of people have talked about the Rockefeller Foundation and lockstep. Lockstep was the scenario where you had a very passive public that did nothing and a very authoritarian, aggressive government that cracked down on them. And that's where we are. But it's interesting to me that that was always what they simulated for 20 years, beginning with Dark Winter, 2 months before 9/11, 2 months before the anthrax attack that happened right after 9/11, a week after. And it's interesting to me they chose the name lockstep because lockstep didn't have anything to do with the people and the government. They were not acting in concert with each other. You had the government as a sole actor, and the people were passive sufferers under that. Now, what is in lockstep are all these governments around the world. They're in lockstep. They're on the same cycle. They're rolling this stuff out at exactly the same time. It is not a response to an emergency situation because they're waiting for months to do this type of thing. And they're gradually doing it. Oh, well, you know, we're going to need to get 60, 70%, I don't know, maybe 75%. And we reach herd immunity, and then that's great. And, you know, it's bad if you don't participate. You know, you should be shamed if you don't do your part to take the vaccine and help us all get free. But then that number just keeps creeping up and creeping up. You have Biden saying 97, 98%. It's 100%. Why is it 100%? Brandon Smith understands that as well. He says, I continue to suspect that the reason for this sudden dive into totalitarianism is because there is something wrong with the vaccines. And if there are tens of millions or hundreds of millions of unvaccinated people left, these people will act as a control group. They can act as proof that the vaccines are not safe. The establishment cannot allow that. Everybody must be vaccinated so they can blame it on something else. That is exactly right. And as I've pointed out, when they did this test, so-called test, And as he points out, look, the average vaccine is tested for 10 to 15 years on animals before it is being used on, before it's used on human beings. And then you run a long-term test on human beings, a small group, for 2 to 3 years before you give it to everybody. And now what they've done with Warp Speed, they've made a virtue of the fact that they've skipped all the testing. They made a virtue of the fact that instead of testing it in a small number of people so you can minimize the harm if something goes wrong, what they did was they rolled it out to everybody all at once. And they said, see, it's a massive test. And it's we've done our long-term test by giving it to everybody. That's not a long-term test. That's a big short-term test. That's a test that skipped the safety part. And so, and what they did, even in that short 2-month test that they did, they then told the people who were in the control group that, oh, well, this is so deadly, we are going to offer you the actual vaccine. They didn't know if they'd gotten a placebo or the actual vaccine. And so what they did was they gave them the vaccine. Now they're going to have the same responses as the other. They've lost their control group. We are the control group, those of us who are unvaccinated. They got rid of the control group in the study within 2 months. They have to get rid of us as the control group because we exposed the lie in the same way that the organizations such as churches who showed up in the middle of this panic campaign, this propaganda campaign, this prop-demic. In the middle of all of that, as they were ramping it up, as they were adding more and more regulations and saying, now it's not just the social distancing and the mask, and then now you can't sing and so forth, they said, all right, we're done. Took off the mask, got together shoulder to shoulder and started singing, and nobody died. And that exposed that it was a lie to the people who were paying attention. The media did the best they could to vilify the churches that were doing that. They did the best they could to make sure that you didn't see that. I did the best job I could to make sure that you did see it. But that is why they were coming after these churches. That's why in Canada they would arrest the pastors. They would close off the churches. They still couldn't stop them from meeting together. And they didn't die. That was the control group. That control group, those churches who continued to meet, showed that none of these things mattered. And it also showed us what we needed to know about how dangerous this pandemic was and how ineffective all of these measures that were being dictated were. So by not having us vaccinated, this is going to then show the danger of these vaccines. He said, I believe we have less than a year left before we see them attempt full-bore medical tyranny in the U.S. on a scale similar to what is happening right now in Australia, perhaps worse. He said, this papers please, this is Brandon Smith, this papers please fascism that is rolling out among larger businesses and big box retailers will include fines against businesses and, of course, as we talked about, $70,000, $700,000 fines. National Guard troops take over medical duties. If you are familiar with the sordid history of VA hospitals, then you know that you do not want to be around 90% of the military doctors operating in any capacity. And so he said, we just have to keep reminding ourselves and reminding them and standing together with each other. These are color of law violations of the Constitution and of the Bill of Rights. They should be defied at every opportunity. This is not legitimate authority. This is not legitimate authority. And we understand that when you see, and again, going back to the people who are conservative, the people who are Christians, the people who like to obey authority and get along with others, it's ingrained in them. You want to obey authority, you obey the Constitution. Because you are not the rebel. Biden and these other people who are pushing this, they are rebelling against legitimate authority. You are not. It's very clear that they don't have the authority to act as dictators. We don't have dictators in the Constitution. We have a division of power. And we have magistrates, not even lesser magistrates. The state governors are not lesser magistrates. The local officials within a state are lesser magistrates. But the state governors are not lesser magistrates. They are co-equal as a branch of government. And the presidency is not beneath the Supreme Court. And neither is Congress. So these people need to stand up to this usurped authority. He says, all this is over a virus with a tiny median death rate of 0.26%. Think about that. I talked about how, going back to Tulane University, the National Primate Center, I guess it was about 2013. It was just before, right about the time, all of this information started breaking out about all the different accidents that we were having in biosafety level 3 and biosafety level 4 labs. But that was one that was very interesting. They had a biosafety level 3 lab. They had brought in a pathogen, a bacteria, Burkholderia pseudomallei. It was only found in two places on Earth. It had, once it you got it, that had a case fatality rate of 45%. 45%. We're talking about something here that is 0.26%. It's a quarter of a percent. We're talking about something that was 200 times more fatal than COVID. And they brought it into that university, tested it on the monkeys, because they wanted to make it more dangerous, and more easily spread. Gain-of-function research. And then they found some monkeys outside of the lab that were infected with it. It's like, whoa, how did that happen? That's not supposed to happen. How did they get out of there? Exactly. So, all this gain-of-function stuff. They're bringing stuff in that is already 200 times more fatal than COVID, and they want to weaponize it. These people that you are taking orders from, these people that you are trusting as authorities, these people who are telling you what science is, they have made a science out of death. They've made a science out of deception. He says, I think it's a no-brainer that red states should offer help for military personnel that are facing discharge for vaccine refusal. Why isn't that being done here in Texas? As I said at the very beginning of the show, Abbott said, well, I'll give jobs to the Border Patrol, but he isn't going to protect the jobs of the hospital workers in Houston, is he, over the vaccine? Political posturing. And it would actually, when it actually be to his advantage to do that. A fight is coming, make no mistake about it. Free states need as many trained combat veterans on our side as we can get. Being dishonorably discharged makes future employment difficult in many career fields. And we can help these men and women to live normal lives if they make a stand. States like Kansas are already taking steps to make this happen. And let me just say this. I know that Biden wants to punish these people. There was an attempt in the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act. There was an attempt to put something in there. That funds all the military spending. So they put in there a rider, a couple of Republicans did. Said, all right, if you kick people out for not taking the vaccine mandate, they should get at least an honorable discharge. How weak is that? I mean, these people should be fighting the vaccine mandate. Instead, they're saying, all right, you can kick them out of the military, but, you know, don't give them anything other than an honorable discharge. To me, that was just damning weakness for the GOP. But even that was not accepted by Biden and the Democrats. No. They want to rub their nose in it. They want it to be a dishonorable discharge. Let me tell you, there is no more honorable discharge than to be kicked out of an organization because you are going to be faithful to God. That is the most honorable discharge you could ever have. Never be ashamed of that. Be proud of that. That doesn't say anything negative about you. It says everything negative about this corrupt government. This corrupt government that has gotten out of its lane, this corrupt government that has assumed all power, and this corrupt government that is in defiance of God. We'll be right back.
Has your news been censored, banned over and over again? Has vital information been held prisoner by mainstream and anti-social media? It's the duty of every thinking person to make the great escape to thedavidknightshow.com. There you'll find links to live streams, videos, audio podcasts, and support links. Live stream the show at DLive and Trovo every Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Eastern. Videos at BitChute and YouTube. New audio podcast, The Real David Knight Show, at Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, iHeart, Spotify, and more. But even though there's a light at the end of the tunnel, without your support, the show will run out of gas. The links to support the show are at thedavidknightshow.com. To donate via Subscribestar, donate via or donate via Cash App, Bitcoin, or P.O. Box. Our sincere thanks to all of you who have stood with us to get this far. Please don't forget to share the links and pray for the country as well as our family.
Looking for better information? APSRadioNews.com features articles and commentary, along with audio from all the top news from around the world. APSRadioNews.com.
Before we get into headline news and we talk a little bit more about what's going on with the vaccines and the lockdowns around the world, and this is happening around the world, same thing, just a different rate, as I said. The plan is the same. They're all on the same page. Sometimes the timing, like it is with these vaccine mandates, is synchronizing up. But for the most part, they're going at a different pace based on what you will put up with. Now, let me just say this. Freedom is never taken. Freedom is surrendered. And then it has to be taken back. And so this is why these people understand. That's why they are going at a different pace. I want to read a couple of letters that people have sent, emails, questions, and this one is from a person who is in New Caledonia, and I'll send, this is, well, I won't mention his name at all, even the first name here, but in New Caledonia, French South Pacific territory near Australia and New Zealand, and telling us what the situation is there, and asking me a question about what to do about this from a moral standpoint. So I'll give my opinion, but everybody has to make their own choices about where they stand, because you're not going to answer to me, you're going to answer to God. And you must not defy your conscience. As a matter of fact, I have people who have sent me questions. Somebody I sent back a reply to today, and I apologize to this individual. I will get you, I'll send this to you by email. I printed this out a few days ago, and it was Wednesday, the September 29th, a couple of days ago. And I meant to respond to him directly, so in case they don't get this. But one of the persons who contacted me this morning said, you've mentioned letters that people could use for religious exemptions. I have a friend who needs one. Could you tell me places where I could get it? Let me just restate that again then for everybody. I gave him a reply directly. I had put up some stuff initially from Solari.com. They probably still have that. LifeSite News. LifeSite News also has, at the very top of the website, they have information about getting a religious exemption in Canada as well as for Americans. So they have two different links up there at the top in red, right there. Thank you. Thank you, Travis. LifeSite News, S-I-T-E, LifeSiteNews.com. I've also had a listener who wrote an excellent letter that was, he's in the military, and went through a lot of different aspects of it. And that's a good outline for you to use. Always use your own words so it's believable to these people. Write in your own style. Everybody has a different vocabulary that they use, and they can spot plagiarism. So make sure that it's sincere. Make sure that it's not plagiarized. But you can use those same talking points. He breaks it down. This is four or five things. And I actually posted that letter on my social media accounts. On Twitter, I'm at Libertarian. Not Libertarian, but Libertarian. Different from the party. I'm about liberty. I don't think they are anymore. So Libertarian on Twitter. And on Gab, David Knight Show. Because I didn't really open up my account on Gab until December this last year, when things were really changing quite a bit. So at the David Knight Show on Gab, not the David Knight, David Knight Show on Gab, and Libertarian on Twitter, you will find that that letter. You may have to go back through a lot of posts for a couple of weeks. There was also another letter that was sent to me by a pastor, covered a lot of the same information, but in that letter, I don't think I put copy that letter and put it on social media. I'll probably repost those. Should bring those up to the top. Put both of those up there and put them on the top. But the other letter was about the importance of conscience and how you don't you don't do something that is against your conscience. You have to be absolutely convinced that it's the right thing to do. Frankly, that's more important. The most important thing there is to not violate your conscience. And your conscience should be informed not by your feelings, but by an objective standard. And so your conscience should be based on your understanding of the Word of God. But having said that, people are going to come to different conclusions based on their reading of the Word of God. But do not violate your conscience. Make sure that you can defend it from an objective standard, not your subjective feelings, but an objective standard, and you can defend that in your letter. So let me get to this question from him. So he says, we're in New Caledonia, it's a territory near Australia and New Zealand. We are staring down the barrel of $17,000 fines for walking around while being unvaccinated. These are administrative fines, a rough French equivalent of civil asset forfeiture, because there's no due process, no proper trial. So far, the illegal, quote-unquote, law doesn't provide for further sanctions for repeat offenders or non-payment. But technically, they could slap us with these fines every day if they liked, and they could lock us up for not paying them, plus confiscate them from payroll before our salaries even reach the bank. The well-attended monthly demonstrations against vaccine mandates, and he puts vaccines in quotes, he understands it's not a vaccine, and health passes have had no effect on the French or the territorial authorities, who just keep steamrolling ahead with their agenda. So a trade union has decided to call a general strike for the 11th of October with a demonstration outside the High Commissioner's mansion. That's the French colonial governor. The dilemma that my wife and I are facing is that we're both Christians and we're anti-socialist communists. We've never been unionized in our lives. But to cover for our absence from work legally on the demonstration date, we need to be members of this particular trade union so as not to get the sack for being AWOL. But joining and paying dues to an organization that champions socialist, feminist, and other woke causes is a pill that is hard to swallow. What would you do if you were in our shoes? Well, I look at this, and you know, we and again, everybody is going to have to be convinced in their own mind. I think about the fact that I have to pay dues, if you will. That's the way I see taxes, as dues, to an organization, the government, that is champions socialism, feminism, other woke causes, and even worse, unlike that union that's there in New Caledonia, this union that I pay taxes to also goes around the world killing innocent people by the hundreds of thousands in my lifetime, millions probably. They have programs to lie, cheat, steal. They have classes on it, as a matter of fact. They assassinate people. They do all kinds of things. Now, I could drop out and not pay taxes as a protest. But I also realize that there are, you know, if possible, as much as depends on you, be at peace with other people. There's also the advice in the Bible when Israel was taken captive into Babylon. Jeremiah told them, he said, grow gardens, pray for the government that you're in, even though it's a corrupt government, pray for that government. Grow your gardens, build your homes, raise your families, do things like that, and then try to live within that system as much as it depends on you. While at the same time, you can try to change that, even though you may not have any effect on doing that. That's the passage right there, by the way, that so many people love to put on plaques. I know the plans I have for you. Plans to prosper, not to harm. And the plan for that was to have these people live in captivity, which is where we're all living. Is there any government? Well, not every government goes to the extent that our government goes to in terms of wars and assassinations. But is there any government on earth right now? I could name one or two, probably Poland and Hungary at the moment, that don't embrace the socialism, feminism, woke policies. And so our very participation in that, you can also look at it from the standpoint that if it helps you to keep your job, and if it is a real union, they will push back on some of these vaccine mandates for you as well. You could see them as co-belligerents on some limited issues and issues that are going to be there nevertheless. And I think that we have to understand that our major ability to change things is not even going to be in terms of speaking or political action. Our main ability to change things is going to be the power of God in prayer and our obedience and faithfulness to Him and leaving that to Him. So, you know, if so that's what I think about it, and you will have to, you should be led by your own conscience in this particular issue. I know it can look like a compromise, but I think that there are nobody, unless we leave this world and go live in a monastery, there's always going to be some compromise in what we do. I know that sounds like a cop-out, but that's the reality. So you can either live in a monastery, self-sufficient, growing your own vegetables, or there's going to be some level of compromise. Christ said, I didn't call you out of the world, but to not be of the world. And so Solzhenitsyn, as he was living in the Soviet Union, and he said, live not by lies. He said, even if I have to compromise with these people, I do not accept this as being true, because that was the ultimate point of the totalitarian society that he lived in the Soviet Union. It's what George Orwell wrote about when it was important for these people to get you to say what you knew was not true, 2 + 2 = 5. And that was what Solzhenitsyn said. He said, even if I have to compromise in order to feed my family and go along with this stuff, I know internally that it is not that you know, I am just compromising in order to feed my family. I'm not buying into this. I don't believe this. I will not support it. This is another listener who says, hello, I follow you on Odyssey. I'm writing with a story suggestion I think is very important. I don't see anybody investigating or reporting on it. If you go to CMS.gov, CMS is the organization that funds Medicare and Medicaid. And this is really kind of the, this is another hook that the Biden administration has in order to make these vaccine mandates go out. And it's one of the reasons why you're seeing it happening in the hospitals first. Because when the hospitals take Caesar's coin, the Medicare, Medicaid payments, they say, well, we're not going to give you any payments unless you do everything that we say. So that means that you're going to vaccinate everybody 100%. And the same way they come in with a Title IX and they say, well, we're not going to give you any money for your athletic program that you're now dependent on because we gave you that money and it was all free cash. You got used to it. You're addicted to it. And you want more of it, don't you? Yeah, no matter how much you got, you need a little bit more. But we're going to cut you off. It's like the drug dealer coming in and giving you the first few hits of heroin or whatever for free. And then threatening to cut you off if you don't do various things for them. And that's what they're doing. That's the way they get the boys and the girls' showers and the locker rooms. So we're going to cut off that Title 10 or Title 9. I forget which one it is. Title 9 or 10. We're going to cut off that funding to your athletic program if you don't do this. And that's what CMS is doing to the hospitals. You vaccinate everybody or we're going to cut off the money. And so he said, if you go to CMS, you will find information on a new public-private partnership. It's all about healthcare claims. I don't need to tell you how healthcare claims are at the center of everything that's going on. Also, that healthcare claims contain medical records and medical records are supposed to be kept private. Well, our government is sending everything to a trusted third party who is not named. I don't know who trusts this third party, but it certainly isn't me. Isn't it interesting that nobody is reporting on this new public-private partnership? Yes. Yes. And I've got a story coming up with the Second Amendment where California is essentially doing that now with gun owners as well. Everywhere you turn, it's all about the surveillance, isn't it? Because the surveillance is the other side of the coin of the police state. Would like to know just a little bit about you for our files, Mrs. Robinson. Look around you, all you see are sympathetic eyes. And We're going to see everything about you. Everything that you do is going to be available to us. So it is about violating our medical privacy and every other aspect of this, and using CMS, Medicare and Medicaid as a hammer to get this information from people. And, of course, in a medical tyranny, and that's what we're in right now, it's necessary for them to know what you have done and what you haven't done so they can force you to have the vaccine or whatever else is coming down the line that they're going to demand that you have. She has a PS here, which is a very heartbreaking story here. She says, by the way, my 27-year-old son, born with one damaged kidney and other disabilities, lives at home. I am his care partner for in-home hemodialysis. We have not taken the injection. For us, it is certain death. My sister took the jab and experienced intense pain and paralysis in her arm, neck, shoulders, and back so bad that she had to take workman's comp for 2 months. If that happened to me, I could not give my son his life-saving hemodialysis. And if my son got the injection, he would probably die at the clinic. So that's Pam. Pray for her and her situation. We are all in a very difficult situation right now, aren't we? I want to get to the headline news before we get into more information about the toxic vaccines. And also, I've got a lot of Second Amendment news here that I think you're going to find interesting. In terms of headline news, we had this this bill that's been bouncing back and forth. $3.5 trillion, they say, but most people believe it'll be $5.5 trillion. And the people who are standing against it, as we pointed out when I talked to Steve Malloy, the liberals, the progressives, are very, very furious about this. As a matter of fact, it's the squad versus the moderates, if you will. Mod squad. Play the theme song for that. Anyway, so it's the mod squad fight that is happening in the Democrats. And the question is, will Joe Manchin switch parties? You know, that is a possibility based on what he's been saying. I don't know what his conservative values are, but he does have a problem with what is being pushed through, and they decided that they would not vote for it. So even though they got a continuing resolution for the budget, they were trying to use the fact that the budget was coming due as a leverage to try to push through this radical agenda. Manchin said no. As a matter of fact, before the vote was held, he said the Democrat spending plan is, quote, a definition of fiscal insanity, unquote. And he said that he would not, quote, re-engineer social fabric with a vengeful taxation. That's better than what most of the Republicans have said about it, actually. Not that I'm not jumping on Team Manchin. I'm just saying, issue by issue, issue by issue, you pick your co-belligerents. The people are going to fight with you. Anyway, he said, I can't support a $3.5 trillion more in spending when we've already spent $5.4 trillion since last March. How much is enough? At some point, all of us, regardless of party, must ask that simple question. He said, we can't even pay for the essential social programs like Social Security and Medicare. That is the definition of fiscal insanity. Also, to continue to do the same types of things that you've been doing over and over again, thinking that you're going to get different results. He said, our tax code should be reformed to fix the flaws of the 2017 tax bill and to ensure that everyone pays their fair share, but it should not weaken our global competitiveness or the ability of millions of small businesses to compete with the Amazons of the world. And so because of that, he voted against this. And the Daily Caller says, if you go back to May of 2001, you had Republican Vermont Senator Jim Jeffords switched parties to become an independent, and then he caucused with the Democrats. He had been a Republican. What that did was that switched the balance of power in the Senate. It transformed South Dakota's Tom Daschle from Senate Minority Leader to Senate Majority Leader. And quite frankly, if Joe Manchin decided that he would become a Republican, or even if he went independent and then caucused with the Republicans, that would change that would remove Chuck Schumer and put him in with Mitch McConnell. Sinema is also coming in for a lot of criticism, but if you look at where they are in their state, as a Daily Caller pointed out, Sinema won a close 2020 election with just 2.34% in a state that Joe Biden carried against Trump by only 0.3% out of 3.4 million votes. Manchin was reelected in 2018 in West Virginia by less than a 4-point margin in a state where Trump won by 40 points. 40 points. West Virginia was probably the strongest state that went for Trump in 2016. So when he's looking at the political landscape in his state, they are pulling away from the Democrats. And the Democrats are pulling away from Joe Manchin and pulling away from Kristen Sinema. On The View, Joy Behar blew up and said that the two of them were enemies of democracy. Well, they're getting pretty close there, you know. I mean, those of us who are conservatives are enemies of the state. We are terrorists. They're getting pretty close to calling them terrorists. She said, these people are destroying the country, in my opinion. Why? Because they won't spend another $5.5 trillion when we just spent $5.5 trillion last year. I mean, the cumulative debt from the beginning of this society, as Trump went in, I think it was about $20 trillion at that point in time or less. And now that it has exploded. I don't remember what the cumulative debt was at the time that Trump went in, but I do remember that in 2019, people were wringing their hands and saying, we're on a path here to have a deficit of nearly $1 trillion, $900 billion. So we're 0.9 trillion deficit. This is outrageous. We can't sustain this. And all the left was saying that at the time. This is horrible. Look at what Trump has done. We're going to add nearly $1 trillion to the debt. Well, the next year, we added $5.5 trillion. And they're demanding more. And they want another $5.5 trillion this year. I mean, we're talking about increasing the deficit like 6 times more than that every year. And they're saying that's not enough. Joy Behar also said, she is very entertaining, isn't she? She said, Trump's going to win in 2024, and he might win because of all the cheating that's going on. So she admits there's a lot of cheating going on. There's always been a lot of cheating going on in these elections. Just newsflash, folks. Always a lot of cheating, and that's nothing new. So the infrastructure vote has been postponed. All of this progressive stuff has been postponed. They have now reached a continuing resolution, the House and the Senate, but they haven't passed any of this other stuff. So, you know, when you look at all the different things that are in this bill, the $700,000 fines for businesses that don't have all their employees mandated, the breathalyzer mandates for every car, and just on and on, all of the insanity in the name of the infrastructure bill, in the name of continuing this, and much of it has absolutely nothing to do with anything other than a radical social agenda. So that's good. You know, the $80 billion for 80,000 new IRS agents, I would like to see that not happening. That is, the rest of the Democrat agenda is in limbo, and they're deadlocked on that. But when it comes to the debt ceiling, and now they've extended this to December the 3rd, and they'll have to vote on it again or do something about it again on December 3rd. Yet Janet Yellen, who is now the Treasury Secretary, she used to be head of the Federal Reserve, she is saying that we need to just get rid of the debt ceiling altogether. Who cares? I mean, yeah, who cares? I mean, we're adding $5, $6 trillion a year to this. Who cares? Every one of the Democrats running had a plan, a wish list, a Santa Claus list of things that they wanted to do. And you total them up, and they went anywhere from $30 to $60 trillion, what they wanted to spend. So, I mean, this is chump change. Who should worry about this? Not only that, we've gone way beyond Keynesian economics. We now have MMT, the modern monetary theory, which says that it absolutely makes no difference whatsoever what the government spends, or just makes up all the monopoly cash that they print up. It doesn't matter. I call MMT the magic money tree because that's really what it is. And so Janet Yellen says, well, we just remove the debt ceiling altogether. And Biden's nominee for the top bank regulator, that's the person, the office's comptroller of the currency, is somebody who grew up in the Soviet Union. She grew up in what is now Kazakhstan. But she grew up in the Soviet Union, came to the United States in 1991. And she says, while she has earned the Lenin Award, as in Vladimir, not John, she has praised the USSR's equality. And, oh, by the way, if you want somebody in as a top bank regulator in the Biden administration, you want to get somebody who is going to end banking as we know it. Just like he put in Chipman to be head of the ATF because Chipman wanted to end gun ownership. His top bank regulator wants to end banking as we know it. These people are intent on radically altering everything in society. And, you know, quite frankly, I think everything needs to be radically altered in society. But it needs to go back status quo ante. I've said many times, conservatives are too locked in to these current institutions in order to be able to jettison them or effectively reform them. We have to think like these people are thinking. They've got an agenda. They have a vision for their society, which I totally reject. But for the longest time, they've all said, think globally. Think about your global agenda and then enact it locally. And that's smart. We have to do that. We also have to look at these institutions that have failed. We have to acknowledge that they have failed, like our schools, for example. And we have to rethink them. We have to get rid of the old institution if necessary and not necessarily replace it with something. Right? We need to get rid of, for example, the Department of Education, replace it with nothing. Federal government should have no involvement in education whatsoever. I don't like to see government involvement in education at any level, but certainly not at the federal level. But going back to this banking regulator, the top banking regulator wants to end banking as we know it. She's a Cornell University law professor. Her name, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, is Sole Omarova. And she wants to make the institution more inclusive, efficient, and stable. She is a woke, radical Marxist from the Soviet Union. She said, until I came to the U.S., I couldn't imagine the things like gender pay gap that still exist in the world today. Say what you will about the old USSR, but there was no gender pay gap there. And that's right. Everybody had nothing. That's what I'll say about the old Soviet Union. Communists, they have absolutely nothing, and they want to share that with you. That's what she wants to do. That's what she wants to do. She supports several progressive proposals, including the Green New Deal, the creation of a giant bureaucracy that she has dubbed the National Investment Authority. Now, this is a full-on Marxist organization. It would coordinate the long-term economic strategy for the United States, including the upcoming infrastructure developments. It would also manage a big and bold climate agenda. I wonder if they got five-year plans like all these little Marxist dictators do, right? Doesn't say anything here about a five-year plan, but they got plans for everything. It would fund affordable housing. It would fund public transit. It would fund clean energy projects. It would fund climate change mitigation solutions, she told Congress this year. As the Wall Street Journal editorial board notes, Ms. Omarova thinks that asset prices, pay scales, capital, and credit should be dictated by the federal government. In a recent paper of hers, The People's Ledger, I don't know if she wrote that paper or if this is a title of an article that she wrote or if that is a paper that she had an interview with. Anyway, The People's Ledger, we know where that's coming from, right? That probably sounds like a Marxist organization. Anyway, she proposed that the Federal Reserve take over consumer bank deposits, effectively end banking as we know it. Why? Because she wants to institute a central bank digital currency. She explicitly said so. She'd also like the U.S. to create a central bank digital currency, as Venezuela and China are doing. Because, you know, we want to be Venezuela and China. If you're a Marxist, you want us to be like Venezuela and China. She wants everything to be controlled. She wants the Federal Reserve to mandate prices. She wants the Federal Reserve to mandate worker wages. And she wants to end banking as we know it. and she wants to create a central bank digital currency. This is how radical the Biden agenda is, really. The first country in Africa to implement a central bank digital currency is now Nigeria. They've implemented it. Yet another thing to be on the lookout for if you get an email from a prince from Nigeria offering you some central bank digital cash in exchange for what people are currently using. Senate has just passed Biden's Afghan resettlement bill, 65-35. This will authorize uncapped entry from Afghanistan and uncapped welfare payments to people from Afghanistan, even as Biden is denying charter flights to get Americans out of there. And as Stephen Miller tweeted this out, he said, just six more no votes from the GOP would have killed this because it would have been under 60. But the GOP wants uncapped immigration from Afghanistan and uncapped welfare payments. Yesterday, as I'm sure you saw, we had the Ron Paul Institute's channel suddenly deleted by YouTube. Why? Because no dissent is going to be allowed anywhere. And then when there was a big outcry for Ron Paul, they eventually, first he appealed to them. He said, we've had the Ron Paul Institute channel deleted by YouTube. No warning, no strikes, no evidence. Well, join the club. That happened to me a little bit more than 3 years ago. They never gave me an explanation. Terminated me in the middle of, it was guilt by association. I didn't have any strikes on my channel. They sent me an email. They cut it off like the last 15 minutes. We were streaming to YouTube. They cut it off like the last 15 minutes of the three-hour program. And got one email. A complaint has been filed against your channel, and it has been permanently deleted. One strike? We have one strike rule now? And they didn't even say what the complaint was. They would not respond to any correspondence. They sent me that same email at a somewhat irregular interval. It would vary from about every 8 minutes to 15 minutes. And they did that for a couple of months. It was such an annoying thing. I set up a filter to put them in a folder. And then when they stopped doing it, I looked at the number of emails in the folder, and it was over 8,000 emails they sent to me over a period of about 2 or 3 months. But they would not respond to any correspondence. They would give no explanation, none whatsoever. A complaint was received. I got the same treatment from PayPal. Well, I don't see that there's anything specific on your account here. It's just they just marked that you're gone. I don't know who was complaining. Yeah, was it James Clapper? Somebody like that? But they get an order from somebody in the government, and they just, you're gone. So they said even as he did appeal to them, and they did send him a message back, and they said, well, we've decided to keep your account suspended based on our community guidelines and terms of service. So I took a screenshot of that, and he put it up on Twitter. And then everybody started hammering YouTube, and they eventually said, well, we made a mistake. We made a mistake, and they restored it. They never give any information. They don't have to because they are the rulers. Jeffrey Tucker, a libertarian scholar who runs the Brownstone Institute, says this is, quote, an attempt to purify all platforms of dissent, and it's getting worse by the hour. Yes, that's right. It really is. We're talking about different things that governors could do to fight against this vaccine mandate. The type of thing that was suggested by Brandon Smith, just make sure that you open up even hiring in state government. You put a priority on people who have gotten discharged from the military because they wouldn't take the vaccine. Say, we're not going to pay attention to that dishonorable discharge. As a matter of fact, that is a recommendation for you to work for us. Now, they could do things like that, and there's nothing that Biden could do to stop that. You can push back against that. In the same way that Trump didn't even have to use the powers, the immense powers that he had as president to protect our God-given right of free speech from these technocrats who are working hand in glove with the governments, as I pointed out yesterday. Trump didn't have to do anything as president because he was so popular. He could have moved from Twitter to Gab, and that would have been the most effective thing that he could have done. It would have been a market-based approach without any coercion, without any regulation, without any Supreme Court review, none of that stuff. He could have just moved to Gab. He didn't do it. And what does that tell you? McAuliffe and Youngkin, I talked about the debate yesterday. Everybody was talking about the comments that McAuliffe made, which should be completely disqualifying for him. The fact that he says, we're not going to let parents tell us what to teach in school. Forget about that. You know, we'll pick the books that we're going to have there. We don't want any input from you. Thank you very much. And that was not the only thing that they clashed over in their debate. The election, I think, is, I don't know if it's, let's see, we're 5 weeks away from Election Day. So I think that might have been their last debate, or either that or it was the first debate, but it was widely covered. But in the debate, they also talked about vaccines. And I want you to see why Eric Peters called this Republican Youngkin kind of a Mitt Romney Republican. The first question of the night dealt with the coronavirus pandemic, and the candidates maintained the positions that they've consistently outlined on vaccine mandates, which McAuliffe generally supports and Youngkin does not. Youngkin said McAuliffe, wants employers to fire employees who don't get the vaccine. And Youngkin says, I'm vaccinated and I think everybody should get it, but I don't think you ought to be fired. They like to straddle the fence that way. McAuliffe said Youngkin's position on the issue was disqualifying. His position, McAuliffe's position on education is disqualifying. But anyway, at that point, to settle this, see, it's not a debate because they didn't have these guys debate this. They didn't have a discussion on the issues. Instead, you had the so-called moderator, Chuck Todd from NBC, jumps in and he starts hectoring the Republican. And so he presses Youngkin on whether or not he believed that getting vaccinated for measles, mumps, or rubella, the MMR shot, is that a personal choice? Youngkin struggled to find his words for several seconds, and then he said, quote, I think the data associated with those vaccines is something that we should absolutely understand the difference between this vaccine. So he kind of hems and haws, and he says, well, that's a different vaccine. This is not the same as those vaccines. It's kind of what he was trying to get at. When asked again, he says he thinks that those vaccines can be mandatory.
They have to get the shot.
Yeah, that's right.
Vaccinations are so important.
No religious exemptions.
Going around now, they have to get their shot.
Yeah, no religious exemptions, no medical exemptions. You have to get the shot. You just do what we say. Yeah, to tell people that the vaccine is going to save you, that's wonderful. That I did a photo op where I had people supposedly injecting me with this thing. And then to say that, but I don't want you forced to do this. That is so weak that it really isn't going to make much difference one way or the other, frankly. A new law is going to require you to listen to Greta Thunberg lecture before you purchase gasoline. This is Babylon Bee. But it's pretty close to the truth. The Babylon Bee satire says, New York, California, Oregon, Hawaii, and several other progressive states will require you to listen to a Greta Thunberg lecture before purchasing gasoline. You'll have to stand there for a 20-minute lecture by the 16-year-old climate activist. Well, by the way, you'll still be able to, even after listening to the 20-minute lecture by Greta Thunberg, you'll still be able to fill up your car faster than somebody can charge their electric vehicle. But at least there's that. We want to make sure that drivers are informed, said Gavin Newsom. So we're having them get lectured by a 16-year-old. So they will have all the facts before they do something rash, like put gasoline in their cars to go to work. He said that once you're finished with the Greta lecture, you'll be prompted to complete a quick 15-question quiz to show that you understand how horrible it is for you to drive a car. Drivers who get at least 80% will then be allowed to refuel their vehicles. As they refuel, the screen will simply play a clip of Thunberg saying, "How dare you? How dare you?" over and over again. The law, of course, will not apply to celebrities who are purchasing fuel. And I actually, I have, you know, that's a 20-minute lecture. I actually have a preview of a little bit of that lecture, and it goes like this.
Blah, 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 blah.
So much to
this
say.
This is not about some expensive, politically correct green act of bunny hugging or blah, blah, blah. Build back better, blah, blah, blah. Green economy, blah, blah, blah.
She actually has to have notes for this speech.
Net zero by 25, 2050, blah, blah, blah. Net zero by 2050, blah, blah, blah. Net zero, blah, blah, blah. Climate neutral, blah, blah, blah.
Scowling at the audience.
This is all we hear from
smirking.
Our so-called leaders. Words. Words that sound great, but so far has led to no action. Did you hear me? What do we want?
Justice.
When do we want it?
Now.
What do we want?
Justice.
When do we want it?
Now.
They've all got the masks on. Bunch of masked, useful idiots. It's just amazing. Just amazing to see this. I guess the only thing that offends me more than an idiocracy is an angry idiocracy being led by a child, and that's exactly what that is. And all these people applauding her as if she... And she had to have notes for that speech. Okay, well, more than half of China's provinces are now rationing electricity because they don't have enough coal. China is allowed to use coal. They're using more coal than the rest of the world at this point in time. And they need more of it, and they're not scrubbing it. It's not clean. At least 20 Chinese provinces and regions, making up more than 66% of the country's gross domestic product, have announced that they have to have some form of power cuts. Guangdong province, the southern industrial hub, is cutting about 10% of its peak power demands. They are trying to get more coal, and they're allowed to burn it. And, you know, we have a lot. We could sell them out of West Virginia, but that's locked up. We can't touch it. On Sunday, top suppliers of Apple and Tesla reported that they had to suspend operations as the government was limiting power to their factories. Oh, no, you mean I can't get a new iPhone? Well, that's okay. Or a new Tesla, that's okay, too. Tesla, by the way. Tesla was found fully engulfed in flames after a vehicle explosion that left five cars damaged on Long Island. These were cars that were parked on a runway. They were taken by the insurance auto auctions. They're storing these cars that were damaged as part of Hurricane Ida. And as part of that damage, we have, whenever batteries are damaged, they're liable to catch fire and explode. As Eric Peters had pointed out, I had not thought of this the other day. He said, you know, you see all these trucks, these pickup trucks, where people are going to be putting very, very heavy things in them. And guess what? You know, these pickup trucks, they're built on a platform, electric car platform, which is completely a floor of batteries. They're not, put up front or in the back. You know, they're everywhere. They're underneath you everywhere. And so if you've got, and you see these pictures all the time, if you look on YouTube at videos of things going wrong, you'll see somebody with a pickup truck and they'll drop something really heavy in the back of it and take the tires out, they'll explode, or the thing will just kind of crumple. Well, you do that with an electric pickup truck and it's going to explode in flames when you bust those batteries, most likely. So it was fully engulfed in flames, but the response from the fire department was, there's nothing suspicious here. Just like the vaccines, I guess. Meanwhile, you had Elon Musk giving another speech in China, and he's saying, these Teslas that I make are 2-ton death machines. Oh, really? Okay, well, that's kind of interesting. He was actually doing that, though, not to criticize his Teslas, but to criticize people who are drivers. Because as soon as his Teslas learn how to drive and stop crashing into police cars left and right and stop crashing into fire trucks, they seem to have a preference for the cars that they crash into. I guess they're visual in terms of the way they do the driving instead of using LiDAR and other things like that. So it might be that I have a theory that it's the markings on these emergency vehicles, because it's really disproportionate in terms of cop cars and fire trucks. But he called his cars, quote, two-ton death machines. He said the transition period with new technology is always a little bit bumpy. You know, it's a little bit bumpy when you drive a car without even applying the brakes in the back of a police car at 60 miles an hour. It's a little bit bumpy. Hang on, it's a rough ride. The truth is, he said, that people are actually not great at driving these two-ton death machines. Oh, really? So, see, it's not really his cars. It's people. I'm here today because, unlike his cars in self-driving mode, I have never collided in the back of a police car at 60 miles an hour. And they love to say, well, you know, this is all these cars are always learning. You know, whenever they make a mistake, this is what Google loves to tell us, too. They're all connected with each other. We analyze the data, and then we update the software. And so it's the collective experience of all these cars, and all of these cars are feeding their experiences together in this big neural network, and they're learning how to drive better all the time. And so, you know, from that standpoint, you could say that this single driver, Skynet, has crashed into several dozen cars, killing people, and which is something that I've never done in my entire life. So, you know, but I'm the problem. I'm the problem. You are the problem. And this is one of the reasons why I disrespect him and have always criticized him. Besides the crony capitalism and the corruption, besides the fact they always pushed the technocracy, he has pushed the very mechanism of the technocracy, which is to take away your freedom and your mobility and to accrue all power and wealth to himself. Yeah. Elon Musk. He was asked about why people who drive Teslas with full self-driving are made to sign a non-disclosure agreement. He said, I don't know. People don't seem to listen to... And then he paused and he said, I don't know why there's an NDA. I guess we probably don't need it. Okay. Yeah. Meanwhile, let's talk about politically correct ideas. You know, like green cars and self-driving cars and things like that the establishment wants that we don't want, but they're going to be forced on us anyway, like they're trying to force the vaccines on us. How misgendering is becoming the new battleground over discrimination, by Jonathan Turley. He says, both governmental agencies and academic institutions are increasingly treating misgendering as a form of hate speech or discrimination. Well, I don't do misgendering. I mean, when Bruce Jenner pretends that he's a female, I don't refer to him as Ms. I refer to him as Bruce Jenner. But this past week, as he pointed out, you had the ACLU supposedly honoring Supreme Court Justice Darth Vader Ginsburg on the one-year anniversary of her death by rewriting her famous defense of a woman's right to abortion to remove the offensive language, offensive because it referred to women with female pronouns. The ACLU thought that was offensive. While Ginsburg herself likely would have made short work of such woke revisionism, says Jonathan Turley, the incident highlighted a critical crossroads reached in politics and academia in the treatment of misgendering as a form of hate speech or discrimination. And again, it is misgendering, I guess. Is it depends, I guess, on whether or not the gendered person is married or not. Misgendering or misgendering. Point Park University in Pittsburgh notified students that its Office of Equity and Inclusion will enforce rules against misgendering, pronoun misuse, and dead naming for individuals who do not use their classmates' preferred pronouns. As he points out, he said, many of us have no objections to using preferred pronouns, but it is a practical matter, he says, as a teacher, A lot of faculty members try to avoid using pronouns altogether in class rather than looking up a student's designated pronoun. Let's see. I can't tell by looking at you anymore. I can't tell by your name. But, you know, it used to be that you could tell most people by their name, but you could tell by the way they dressed or looked or whatever. But now you can't. So you got to have a cross-tabulation there to remember not only their name but their pronoun. He said that's not really practical. He said confirming the right pronouns can be challenging in the middle of a fast-moving class. Students today identify from a growing list of gender identities. Yes, it's like Star Trek or something, isn't it? Including, but not limited to, gender fluid, third gender, amalga gender, demigender, bigender, pansgender, and agender. Well, I think they do have an agender. It's an agender that I'm not going to be involved with. And the pronouns can include, but are not limited to, he, she, they, them. I tell you, you start talking about yourself in plural pronouns. It just, every time I see this they, them thing, it always makes me think about the demoniac at the Christ encounter. You know, who are you? We are legion. You know, there's a bunch of us in here. When they start using pronouns like they and them, it's like, that's pretty telling right there. They got Z here, Z zir, Spivak. Spivak, that's an acronym, I guess, for a lot of these different ones. Spivak. Anyway, it's crazy. I remember when I was in college, I said, you know, we used to have quite a few Iranian students that had come over. It was, the Shah of Iran was still there. And so Iranian students could come and study engineering in the U.S. And they could have some very challenging names to pronounce. And I remember one time is at the very beginning of the semester, the teacher was calling roll, and after struggling with several of their names, he just got to one person. He says, I'm not even going to try this. And he had a number. I don't know if it was a Social Security number, I think it was, because of those days people didn't really worry about Social Security numbers or some kind of identifying number. And he starts reading it out. It's like a 10-digit number. And he said, what do your friends call you? And kind of laughed. And the person said, 263. It shortened up the 10-digit number. That was a good response, I thought. Very clever from the Iranian. Anyway, some people have religious beliefs, says Jonathan Turley, against following new orders and using such pronouns. Yes, I will not do that. As a result, there are some serious free speech and religious freedom objections to mandatory usage rules. So, you know, how long is that going to last? I mean, when you stop and think about it, if you're going to let these people mandate and inject toxins into your bloodstream, how much longer is it going to be before you let them mandate and inject toxins into your speech? That's what we're talking about here. They don't care what you think. You must bow to them. That's why I've pointed out many times. The two problems that I've got with the LGBT stuff is I don't expect people to follow God the way I understand God. You know, that's something that God does in their life. But they're not looking for tolerance. They don't want you to tolerate them. They demand that you celebrate them. They're going to dominate you, and they have no toleration whatsoever for anybody else. And that's the thing that I must oppose. That and what they do to the kids. There's absolutely no reason that we would allow these types of things that are being done now, K through 12, to being done to underage kids. This is absolutely abhorrent. But both of those things are a big part of their agenda. You know, we hear pride. I was talking the other day about, kind of jokingly, about Mike Pompeo, who likes to talk to Christian audiences. He's building a base of Christian supporters. The same guy who comes to Texas A&M, says to a conservative crowd, you know, West Point, we didn't lie, cheat, or steal, or tolerate those who did. But then I went to the CIA, and we lie, we cheat, we steal, we got classes on it, and they all laugh. They think that's funny. And I said, well, you know, you probably somebody should send him some videos of Ray Comfort, who goes up and down the beach of California and he engages people. He goes, you think there's life after death? Well, what do you think God's going to do with you? And then he gives him a few things. He says, so you think you're pretty good, don't you? You know, most people do. And so he gives him a couple of examples and ever lie and all these other things that Pompeo has already proudly associated with. And yet, you know, he goes down a list of things like, you know, lying and cheating and using God's name in vain, blaspheming his name and some things like that. But, you know, one of the things that he doesn't list when he's doing that is pride. Pride. Pride is one of the things that God really makes a point of saying that he hates, pride. And when you stop and think about it, you know, when you have this movement, you know, we look at pride in the U.S. as being a virtue, right? We're proud to be an American. We're proud to do this. We're proud to do that. We should be grateful. We should say that we're blessed to be Americans. I'm not proud. I try to stomp out pride because I know that if I don't do it, God will do it. You either humble yourself or he humbles you. I'd much rather try to humble myself than to have him do it. But, you know, the whole thing about all of this stuff and the Pride Month and all the rest of that stuff, you know, they're engaged in conduct that God condemns as a sin. And then to double down, they're proud of it. They celebrate it. And they demand that you celebrate it. That's the other part of it. In England, a woman, Kate Scotthow, was arrested following a debate on Twitter over transgender policy. A transgender activist charged her with harassment and deadnaming, using the prior name of a transsexual person. And then in Scotland, a feminist activist, Marion Miller, was charged with, quote, malicious communication. I mean, these are criminal offense. And these other places. And if Nancy Pelosi and company are able to get their so-called Equality Act, it's an equity act, it's to enact this type of thing. If they're able to get that through, it'll become a crime here as well. But this feminist activist was charged with malicious communication due to some tweets that she made that criticized gender self-identification. Not only was she charged by the police, but she was labeled by the Twitterverse mob as a TERF. A TERF. That stands for a trans exclusionary radical feminist. It was nice to see an antidote to this. I should have gotten the clip, but I didn't. Denzel Washington is at a men's leadership conference. Good for him. Men have a role. We have a different role than women. Our role is very important. So are women's roles. And Denzel Washington, who grew up in a family that was, both his mom and dad were strong Christians, but he kind of put it on hold, he said, in his early life. He said in 1975 he'd flunked out of college, but a woman, he said he was waiting for his mother in a beauty parlor, and this woman just kept staring at him and staring at him and staring at him. And she comes over after a long period of time, and she wrote something, and she said to him, wrote it down and gave it to him, so he's got it. And she said, you're going to preach all over the world. And he goes, what? It's the furthest thing in the world from his mind. He said, I just wasn't ready. But 7 years later, he said, I got filled with the Holy Spirit. He said, for many years, he says, I've done good work through philanthropy, tried to be a good guy, but my mother said to me, Denzel, you do a lot of good, but you've got to do good the right way. She said, you know what I'm talking about. You can't buy your way in. You can't love your way in. You've got to serve. You got to serve God. And so he said what he's trying to do, this is a Better Man conference that's going on in Orlando, and or actually just finished, I guess. I think they had it. They aim to, but listen to this, in this society now, they aim to equip, encourage and engage men to be better in Jesus every day of the year. How do we become better husbands, fathers, friends, and co-workers to those around us? He said, in our current climate, are men even allowed to have an impact? He said, well, the world has changed. What is our role as a man? And he laughed and he said, the John Wayne formula doesn't quite fit right now. But he said, we still have some characteristics as men. Strength, leadership, power, authority, guidance, and patience. are God's gifts to us as men. And he further said, if you really want to change things, you want to talk to someone who can change things. He says, talk to someone who can do something about it. Constantly develop the habits of praying. That's right. You do that before you write your congressman. Your congressman probably can't do anything even if he wanted to do anything. He doesn't want to do anything. He doesn't have the power to do anything. So, write him. Let him know. Who knows? Doesn't take too long to do that. It doesn't have to be a convincing letter. You just say, I'm in favor of this. I'm against that. But if you want to get something done, you have a powerful weapon, and the most powerful weapon you have is prayer. He says, I don't drink anymore. I don't do any of those things. But he said to me, the world seems like it's in a crisis. I'm all about the message to the degree that I know it. I'm unashamed, unafraid to share it. So we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and we're talk about the Second Amendment. We've got some updates on the toxic medicine that is being mandated everywhere, as well as new world orders in Australia and everywhere else. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Has your news been censored, banned over and over again? Has vital information been held prisoner by mainstream and anti-social media? It's the duty of every thinking person to make the great escape to thedavidknightshow.com. There you'll find links to live streams, videos, audio podcasts, and support links. Live stream the show at DLive and Trovo every Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Eastern. Videos at BitChute and YouTube. New audio podcast, The Real David Knight Show, at Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, iHeart, Spotify, and more. But even though there's a light at the end of the tunnel, without your support, the show will run out of gas. The links to support the show are at thedavidknightshow.com. To donate via Subscribestar, donate via or donate via Cash App, Bitcoin, or P.O. Box. Our sincere thanks to all of you who have stood with us to get this far. Please don't forget to share the links and pray for the country as well as our family.
Hear news now at APSRadioNews.com or get the APS Radio app and never miss another story.
All right, a quick couple of notes here from listeners. This is from, just got this morning. On Subscribestar. Said, upon seeing your fuel gauge, I went to the Subscribestar page and tried to donate to you via the tips feature using a euro currency containing MasterCard-based debit card. Though I repeatedly tried each time, after initially getting a processing message, I got an unknown error message when attempting to send the money, and they sent me screenshots of it. And said, even tried to see if it would work if I lowered the amount of donation money, but to no avail. Since I neither live in the U.S. nor in the U.K., the other digital options given on your website are of no use. I don't know whether sending cash by mail internationally will survive the journey. I don't really know what to say. I mean, we have gotten some Subscribestar donations and tips, and I just want to thank people for those. We were down quite a bit very late in the month. And in the last week or so, a lot of people have noticed the gas gauge and have contributed. So we're up to 94%, where we ended the month. It's not reflected in the gas gauge yet. I think we have it still at 3/4. And we'll probably put it up to like 7/8, which is still less than it is at 94%. I think last month we were at about the same. It was like 95-96% last month. So it was very close to the goal. I really do appreciate everybody who contributed, and we're able to get things on Subscribestar, so I really don't know what to tell you about that. I will say this. We're looking at some other ways that we can try to monetize the program. I've had some people contact me with some products that they sell, and one in particular, it's a great product. And for people who are starting to, they got a couple of different products that are nice, and they're, it's not a company. It's a family that is into preparation stuff. And so I thought, well, that they have a website and they've developed this product. But, I mean, it's still kind of a small company. I have to be concerned about the kind of stuff that I want to directly sponsor. but I might do that. And we've also looked at trying to monetize the podcast because we've gotten to the point. I appreciate people downloading the show. That's my key thing. I don't want to put it behind a firewall. And if I monetize it through, if I monetize the podcasts, they pick the sponsors and they put them on. I don't really have a say-so about that. And so I might wind up with people that I don't like advertising on there. So I'm not really sure about that. We might give it a try and see how that works out. The other side of that coin is that these advertisers might wind up with a show that they don't like if you become dependent on them. That's why we did it as a donation thing from the beginning. And all of you have been very kind to support us. God has been faithful to provide for us in these 9 months that we've been doing this. So we're looking at some other things, maybe Rockfin. I had a discussion with the people at Rockfin yesterday, and that would be the sort of thing where we would still provide it for free. This show would be simulcast there during the day, and then probably on the weekend I would do an additional show that would be maybe 1 to 2 hours, and that would be available for people who had subscribed to me. And so that might be one way to do that, some additional content. A lot of websites are starting to do that now in terms of, you know, here's a bunch of free articles, and this is one article. Zero Hedge does it, Daily Caller does it. So some of them are doing that. So I thought that might be a way that I don't, if I have a lot of people who subscribe to that. As a matter of fact, the thing I like about Rockfin is that if you subscribe, don't just get my content. I would get paid more if you subscribe because of me, but you could then watch anybody that's on the platform after you subscribe to somebody. And so they do some things like that. So we're looking at that and some other things. But we're still on a donation basis, and so I really do appreciate that. I just want to let people know how we finished up the month. I got one more piece of correspondence here that was sent to me. And this person has and their family have been very faithful to support us, been one of our key contributors. Said that they were considering moving to Indiana due to better homeschool laws. But now, he says, I'm thinking of safety. But she said it's not so good to have it where you stand at home. He said where you stand at home and you stand up and teach. Did you have a separate place for your homeschool? I'm interested in any thoughts you have about this. Looks like I'll be the teacher for my daughter. My son will want to come too. Daughter can already read and add and multiply and do much more. That's great. So got a 4-year-old daughter and a 2-year-old son, and they sent some pictures, Tom did. And so I would just say this, there's a lot of different approaches, and I think one of the nice things about homeschooling is that you can try different things and see what works, and what is going to work for one child isn't necessarily going to work for the other. What worked for my kids isn't going to work for yours either. So you try different things, and there's a lot of different ways that you can do it. Most people, when they start doing homeschooling, the reason I said, don't try to reproduce this at home, because it's been our experience that most of the people who tried to do it that way, who tried to replicate the classroom, they just found that that didn't work very well in a situation where, it's just you and the kids. It's kind of like that awkward thing that Jill Biden did when she went around talking for Joe Biden. And she went to like a nursing home or whatever, and she had a podium put in there, and there's like 5 or 6 old people that are sitting there in chairs, and she's lecturing them from a podium like she's speaking on a stage. It was kind of bizarre, and it's even more bizarre if you've got just a couple of kids that you're talking to that way. And so in a sense, instead of doing something like that, you put them on your lap as you're talking to them, but you give them a desk and give them a place to work. That's a good idea. That's a good start. And then whether you, do some of the instruction yourself, supplement it with some stuff that's online. If you can find some homeschool groups that you can do some co-op with, that also gives them a chance to make some friends and get involved in some of the social stuff, which is good. So all of those things, and you can find where there's homeschool cooperatives in the homeschooling organizations in various states. And you might be able to get some of those resources. It's been a while since we've done it now. You might be able to get some of those resources now with Homeschool Legal Defense Association. I would suggest that people sign up for the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, because if the government starts harassing you, or Child Protective Services start to harass you, because anybody can report you to Child Protective Services for any reason whatsoever or for no reason at all. And you are guilty until proven innocent, so you need to have somebody that you can go to right away. And they do a great job of that. And they continually fight and for our legal freedom to do that. And they keep an eye on the legislation that comes up in various places. And, of course, there's probably also a state homeschooling association that does that type of thing as well. With us, we were, at the time that our kids were really young, we were doing a lot of, in our work, we did a lot of travel because we had six different stores over a three-city area, and so we did a lot of car schooling, and that's what we called it. So the nice thing, what I'm saying about all this is the nice thing about homeschooling is that you will find that you need to adjust it a little bit based on your life circumstances and based on the kids. You know, when you go to a school environment, an institution, it's a one-size-fits-all. And so one of the good things about homeschooling is that you can customize it to your individual kids, and you have the freedom to change things and to try different ways to teach them until you get something that works with them. So I would just say my biggest advice to anybody would be just keep your eyes open, keep your mind open, you know, look at how it's working with the kids, and be flexible. Because that's one of the key things that you have with homeschooling. You can have flexible timing, and you can have a flexibility in terms of the way that you want to do it. That's the beauty of it, quite frankly. It's a lot easier to add extracurricular things or to organize your life when you have control over the schedule. And so just be flexible, be my advice to you. And there's a lot more resources out there now than there were when we were doing it. It's continued to grow, and of course everybody knows, as I've reported, it's exploded over the last year. So there's a ton of resources out there. There's a lot of different curricula out there, and it can be very informal all the way to a very rigorous academic formal instruction, classical homeschooling. Doug Wilson has been involved in some stuff like that. There's a lot of different curricula out there. We just decided that, you know, we were not going to get into it that hard. I didn't know Greek or Latin, for example. You know, you don't have to teach both of those, or you teach one or the other. I didn't know anybody that taught it. So what we did was, just to help their vocabulary, we would get them, found a book at Homeschooling Convention where it had the roots, the Greek and Latin roots to a lot of words, to help them to piece together a vocabulary. So there's a lot of different ways that you can approach it. It's just whatever works. I hope that helped a little bit. We have, by the way, talking about what works, Vladimir Putin was very, he custom-tailored his meetings with different leaders based on what worked for different people. You know, just like you got some kids, little girls can sit there and they can sit in a desk and they can stay there all day, but little boys, they need to get up and move around. Like I've said before, one of my sons, he was just constantly jumping around, and I didn't think anything was getting through to him. And Karen said, "Don't get upset. Are you paying attention? You're jumping around the whole time I'm talking." And Karen said, "Just ask him what you just said." And I asked him, and he knew everything that I just said. And so I was the one who had to get used to the way that he learned. But, you know, Putin watches the different leaders, and he knows exactly how to meet with them. For example, as we saw in this tell-all book from Stephanie Grisham, I'll take your questions now. She was a former White House press secretary. She said that Russia advisor Fiona Hill, when they were having a meeting with Putin and Trump at the G20 summit in Osaka, Japan, that an attractive 36-year-old was brought in as a translator. She said in her book, as the meeting began, Fiona Hill leaned over and asked me if I'd noticed Putin's translator, who was a very attractive brunette woman with long hair, a pretty face, and a wonderful figure. Fiona Hill then proceeded to tell me that she suspected the woman had been selected by Putin specifically to distract President Trump. You know, he's done that type of thing before. When he met with Angela Merkel, turns out, Putin did his research, and he knew that she had a fear of dogs. She was attacked in 1995 by a dog, and she was very much afraid of dogs. Putin had a very docile black lab female, and kind of an older dog, not moving around fast at all. The dog's kind of, you know, walking around. It's an older dog. And they're having a meeting, you know, and how many of these meetings between leaders do you have a dog walk into the room, right? That's pretty unusual. But the dog walked in, and this was back in 2016. Everybody was showing the pictures of it, and it was quite funny. The body language of Angela Merkel, as you can see there, there's the dog, kind of an old dog, and she's very tense. At one point in time, the dog goes up and places its head calmly on her lap, and she gets even more tense. And he's got kind of a smirk on his face. He knows what's going on. So with Merkel, he uses the fact that she was attacked by a dog, you know, about 20 years earlier. For Trump, I guess he decided that he would use the fact that he's been attacked by many beautiful women, counterattacked, I should say. he attacks them first, and they attack him later. So I guess he knew what he needed for each of these individuals. One last general news before we get into Second Amendment here. I found this interesting, the story that came out of BuzzFeed about the Havana Syndrome. And I've been talking about this. I think it first came out in 2017, the first cases of that. And as I said, you know, they started having all these neurological symptoms and physiological symptoms, other things, but mainly, you know, headaches and other things like that, and vertigo and a lot of stuff. And they said, we hear clicking. And so I immediately thought, well, you know, there may be something real to that. The Fry effect, which was discovered by a Navy researcher, Alan Fry, decades ago, he found that if you use certain frequencies of microwaves, that you can actually hear them. It triggers nerves at certain frequencies. It triggers nerves that will make your body think that you are hearing something when there's not actually any audio at all. There's not anything physiological there. There's no sound waves that are hitting your ear. But, you know, what happens is the sound waves, air pressure waves hit your ear. And then that is converted to electrical signals that then go to your brain. And so this just kind of short circuits it. And with the EMF, it creates the electrical signals that makes your brain think that you're hearing crickets. And so I said, that seems like that is a real directed energy weapon at these people. Seems legit to me. And they've had the Congress unanimously vote to compensate a lot of these people who work for the State Department or spies or whatever. 427-0, the House of Representatives voted to pass what they call the Havana Act to compensate CIA and State Department personnel affected by these types of issues recently. And so as that is happening and that's starting to gain traction, whenever I talked about the Havana effect, the thing that I thought was most interesting about that was the biological effects of electromagnetic radiation, EMF frequencies. And always made the case that, you know, when we have microwaves that everybody's got in their kitchen now, microwave ovens. How did that begin? Well, that began by accident as well. You had some radar technicians who realized that when they set their coffee on top of the radar device, that their coffee got hot. And so they started looking at it, and they said, well, you know, we could use electromagnetic radiation in order to heat up coffee or heat up things that have water in them. That's the basis of the microwave ovens. The first microwave ovens, as a matter of fact, by Amana, were called radar ranges, if you remember, because it came from radar. And so in the same way, you had an assistant of Alan Fry who they were using a different frequency, and he started hearing the stuff, and so that got him interested in the biological effects of electromagnetic radiation. Alan Fry did a lot of research on that. He was the only person to do that because the Navy didn't want any more research done by that. You know, he published those results, and they kind of kept him on, but they didn't really give him a lot of money. They didn't hit him with $200 million like they did the Brain Project in order to map out the brain and figure out how they can remove memories and implant memories and the rest of this stuff. No, they didn't want to go down the path of looking at the biological, physiological effects of electromagnetic radiation. Why? Because of cell phones. Cell phones and now 5G. And if there is one thing that President Trump was as gung-ho to roll out as the vaccines, it was 5G. 5G is the infrastructure for the smart cities, for the UN 2030 agenda, for the ability of them to take over driving your car and to limit your transportation, but most importantly, for them to have real-time biometric surveillance of everybody, like they're doing in many of the Chinese cities. They have to have that high bandwidth of 5G. And they don't want anything like physiological effects to get in the way. So they don't want that to go out. And so when I saw this and I read this, it's kind of interesting to me how this is being, this whole purpose of this BuzzFeedNews.com article is to say that the declassified State Department report says that microwaves did not cause Havana syndrome. So this is a 2018 report, November 2018, and they said it was 2 years after dozens of U.S. diplomats in Cuba and their families reported hearing buzzing noises and then experiencing puzzling neurological injuries, including pain, vertigo, and difficulty concentrating. And so they had the Jason Advisory Group. Now, if I've had several people tell me that they've read or got the audiobook of Annie Jacobson about DARPA. Very, very fascinating book. I highly recommend it. And I've had several people say, well, thanks for the recommendation. It's a great book. I need to get her back on. She's got several books. She's got another one about Operation Paperclip that is also highly recommended. But the one that she did on DARPA, she points out that the Jason scientists were the kind of the core group that DARPA grew out of. They found, I forget what the acronym stands for, but they got a group of very intelligent people to be a think tank as an advisory group for these types of projects, and they're still there. And so they had the Jason Advisory Group to the State Department go through and look at this information, and they wrote a paper in 2018, November 2018, saying that they did not believe that there was anything real going on with this. And so their conclusion, which quite frankly I think is a cover-up, it's really absurd. They suggest this is most likely caused by insects. They said what you're hearing is crickets. They said the most likely source is the Indies short-tailed cricket, LOL. How do you explain that it's a specific species of cricket that while it may be indigenous to Cuba, is not to the other places where this happened? Because some of this happened in China. I mean, this is one of the most childish narratives I've ever seen in my life. Not only that, but they really trash it because they say it's mass psychology effects. These people have very real physiological effects, and they called it psychogenic. What is the difference between psychosomatic and psychogenic? The way that I understand it is that when they say that something is psychosomatic, they're saying you get yourself freaked out psychologically, you can actually make yourself sick. This is psychosomatic. It's in your mind, right? But with psychogenic, I believe, it's they're even saying that it's nothing physical. Maybe I've got it the other way around. But I think what they're saying is that it's nothing physical. It's all just in your mind. And there's not even any physical symptoms. And it's a cricket that is very specific to Cuba, which would not explain why this is happening in China as well and other places. No, I think that this is a cover-up. I think this was leaked to BuzzFeed at the same time that this is starting to get traction. At the same time, they want their 5G to go out because that is fundamental to what they must have in place in order to put the plans for this surveillance and control state in. Now, the one thing that they did say in this was they said that in 8 of these cases, they had some people had recorded audio of this. And they did reference the Fry effect. They did not ignore the Fry effect. They said the Fry effect, of course, there's not going to be any, there's no audio at all. We're not talking about sound waves. We're talking strictly about electromagnetic waves. So they said if it was strictly electromagnetic waves, you would not be able to record it on a microphone, of course. And so they dismissed that. But that was only in the case of 8 of the people that there were 21 people that were involved in this. They did add a caveat. They said it cannot be ruled out that while the perceived sounds, while not harmful, are introduced by an adversary as a deception so as to mask an entirely unrelated mode of causing illness. So they said that the Jason scientist and this leaked paper from 3 years ago now puts to rest the microwave attack theory. I think what they're putting to rest is your concerns about cell phone radiation, which are real. We have seen cancer clusters in schools, so they put a cell phone tower that had a lot of concentrated energy close up to the kids for an extended period of time. We see there was one particular in New York. Others, we had the Telecommunications Act, 1996, 10 years after Fauci gave legal liability to the vaccine companies 10 years later because microwave radiation was a big part of their plans. They gave the Telecommunications Act said you're not going to object to antenna placement based on health and medical issues. Only if you have aesthetic objections. In other words, you don't like the way the cell phone tower looks. You think it's ugly. All right, we can work with that. You know, we can dress it up or whatever, but we're going to have it there one way or the other. And but you have had some local jurisdictions, because, folks, that is a federal law. But guess what? You have states that can override that, and you've had local communities that have gone in and said, we don't care what the 1996 Telecommunications Act put in with Bill Clinton. We don't care what that says. You're going to remove that cell phone tower there. And they banned it being around schools, for example. So you still have something that you can do. That's a lesson in a lot of different ways, isn't it? You know, we can push back against this stuff at a local level if we really want to. We can save our kids. We can save our kids from radiation. We can save our kids from the pollution of the schools. There's a lot of different things that we can do. You just have to have the will to do it. And you have to say, well, I don't care if you cut off the money coming from the federal government. Keep your money. You can't buy me off. This is more important, and I'm not going to be bought. Let's talk a little bit about the Second Amendment. We have J.P. Morgan blocked out of the Texas municipal bond market because of their anti-gun positions. There was a bill that was passed in May by the Texas House of Representatives. They passed a bill that would block state and local governments from contracting with banks and other financial services companies if they have policies that limit their work for the firearms or ammunition industry. In other words, these banks, a lot of these big banks, were part of Operation Choke Point in the Obama administration. They particularly singled out firearms manufacturers and firearms retailers for punishment through the banking system. Does this sound familiar when we look at the vaccine mandates? Yes, this is exactly what they're trying to do. So they were trying to exclude from society anybody that had anything to do with guns. And then the Texas legislature did the right thing in getting this bill through. It's too bad that they're not doing that in terms of protecting our freedom when it comes to vaccines. But let's just set that aside for the moment. Operation Choke Point is coming back in many ways, and now it's coming back, it's still there to a large degree against the Second Amendment, against the right of self-defense, the right to keep and bear arms. They've now really kind of expanded that into the First Amendment area. If you look at the situation, Mike Flynn, General Flynn, who was kicked off of, I think it was Wells Fargo was the bank, if I remember correctly. I'm not sure. But it was a bank who sent notification, we don't like your politics, basically, was what it was, and you're now banned. No explanation, really, but just, you know, we don't want to do business with you. It hurts our reputation or something like that. They weren't specific about it. And in the same way that getting kicked out by PayPal and by Venmo, yours truly, no explanation given. They won't say what it is. So this is the way they're using this, strangling people out of the financial system, out of work, things like that. They did that against the Second Amendment. They're doing it against the First Amendment. They're going to do it against people who are not vaccinated. There's a lot of different ways that they're rolling this out. In Texas, guns. And so we're going to... We're going to support that. And so this week, J.P. Morgan was replaced by UBS as the underwriter of a bond issue for the Decatur Authority. That is an arm of the 7,000-person Texas city that operates Wise Health System. So they had a big municipal bond there, and they excluded J.P. Morgan because of their anti-gun stance. In July, the agency had disclosed that it was planning to have J.P. Morgan serve as senior managing underwriter on a financing that could have included the sale of up to $150 million worth of bonds. Texas's fast-growing population, this is on Zero Hedge, by the way, Texas's fast-growing population has made it one of the biggest markets for municipal bond business. Texas-based insurers accounted for $58 billion of debt sales in 2020, the second most of any state behind California. J.P. Morgan was credited with working on a $3.6 billion of a long-term municipal bond deal in Texas in 2020, according to data from Bloomberg. Now, that's a lot of fees that J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, and Citibank will be missing out on from here on out, because they are against the Second Amendment. And then moving to Massachusetts, or I should say moving from Massachusetts, is Smith & Wesson. In Massachusetts, they put through a bill, or well, they actually didn't get it through. They suggested a bill that would have prohibited Smith & Wesson from manufacturing certain guns. They've been there in that area for 170 years, nearly. And in Massachusetts, the Democrats said, we don't want you here. You're making guns. And so they're planning on moving to Tennessee in 2023. They would have been prohibited from manufacturing arms that are legal in almost every state in America, that are safely used by tens of millions of law-abiding citizens every day. They said, quote, while we are hopeful that this arbitrary and damaging legislation will be defeated in this session, these products made up over 60% of our revenue last year. And the unfortunate likelihood that such restrictions would be raised again led to review of the best path forward for Smith & Wesson. So what they're going to do is move 750 jobs to Tennessee, along with a $125 million investment, according to the Wall Street Journal and the Tennessee Department of Economic Development. The lower cost of living was also a factor in the move. A lot cheaper to live in Tennessee than it is in Massachusetts because of taxes. The mayor of Springfield said, we hate to see him go. We'll try to work with them to try to retain 1,000 remaining jobs. According to a person familiar with the move, the company will keep some production in Springfield. They say they're going to continue to produce revolvers there until I guess those are outlawed. They make the 44 Magnum, as Clint Eastwood's character Dirty Harry said, the most powerful handgun in the world. And I guess Massachusetts legislature, the Massachusetts Democrats, are feeling lucky. So Smith & Wesson pulled the trigger. They were founded in 1856 by Horace Smith and Daniel Wesson in New England, eventually settling in Springfield, Massachusetts. And from the middle of the 19th century to today, there have been a lot of U.S. gun makers in what was called Gun Valley. You know, we have Silicon Valley. They had Gun Valley back in the middle of the 19th century. You had firearms manufacturers Colt, Winchester, Smith & Wesson, all headquartered in Gun Valley, an area that stretched from central Massachusetts down into Connecticut. But over the past few years, these areas have become hostile to a gun manufacturer. Another gun maker, Troy Industry, also relocated to Tennessee. Tennessee has become a popular destination for gun makers. Employment in the firearms industry in the state has grown by more than 50% in the past 5 years. Massachusetts and its anti-gun politicians have also made relocation a pressing concern for many firearms manufacturers, besides these two. So what that data actually shows, and this is, now I'm reading from an article, BearingArms.com. I said what the data actually shows is that more people are killed by criminals using their own feet and fists than by a rifle of any kind. But why let the facts get in the way of fear-mongering? These Democrat representatives who introduced the legislation that did not pass, but they know that that it's coming. That's why they're leaving. But the legislation would have banned manufacturing of any assault weapon, whatever that is. You know, there's no definite definition of an assault weapon. But it would ban any assault weapon or any large-capacity feeding device in Massachusetts, unless they're going to sell it to law enforcement or to military. This is the hallmark of tyranny, that only the government is allowed to have guns. That is the antithesis of everything this country was ever about. Our liberties are preserved by an armed citizenry that is a deterrence to tyranny without ever having to fire a shot. That's what that is ultimately about. So the proposed ban on making modern sporting rifles and magazines that can hold more than 10 rounds of ammunition did not make it through to the governor's desk this year, but it will be happening. So the point is why spend any more money doing capital improvements or anything else? Go ahead and make the move now so you can get out before it's a fire sale. The relocation is expected to take place in 2023. For now, anyway, the company plans on keeping production of revolvers there, but we'll have to see what the Democrats say about that. Meanwhile, Salon has written a hit piece on guess who? Smith & Wesson. And they're upset about the fact that they're actually, they said, quote unquote, quietly targeting young boys using social media because they're putting stuff up. And so the question is it cause or effect? Are they marketing to young boys because young boys like guns, or are they marketing to make young boys like guns? We had a friend of ours from church, and we used to let our boys play with guns all the time. I had to go far and wide, as a matter of fact, even when our kids were little in the 1990s, to find guns for them to play with. The only thing I could find at Toys R Us were SWAT team things. You know, it was only allowed to play with guns if you were pretending that you were a SWAT team. It's like, well, I have a problem with that. I don't like SWAT teams. And I think that people other than the government ought to have guns. So, you know, we'd go around, we'd go to historical areas, and I would get them guns in the historical areas. You know, kind of muskets and things like that. And since we had a hard time finding toy guns, I just got them real swords. then the real guns came. But anyway, we had a friend of ours. Isn't that right, Travis? Yeah, he's got a lot of swords. A friend of ours who had a son our age, we knew her through church. She really didn't like our boys playing with guns, and she didn't want her boy playing with guns either. And she said to Karen one day, she said, "But I realized it was something that was ingrained in the little boy." She said, "I saw him out in the yard by himself, and he picked up a stick, and he's going around going, pew, 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 bang, bang, bang." It's like, yeah, it's just like Toy Story. Not Toy Story, Christmas Story. The Red Ryder BB gun, right? Salon is saying, you'll shoot your eye out, kid. largely appears to be the case, they said, with Smith & Wesson, that they're marketing towards younger audiences. I said Smith & Wesson engages in many of the tactics discussed above in terms of showing people with guns and showing people using guns and things like that. As this article points out, heaven forbid that we would have young people watching a Julie Golub or a Jerry Masulik, I guess. I don't know either one of these people, with a video showing how to use firearms safely and responsibly. Yeah, because that's what, a lot of what they are doing in these videos that they have. But they said, going back to Salon, they said there's pictures of teens shooting guns, drawing dubious associations between its products and the military. Well, you know, in Massachusetts, they only want them to sell guns to the military. Smith & Wesson also apparently employs its own influencers, and it sponsors shooters to connect with audiences. And this is all coming from Bloomberg's Every Town, the gun control organization. And I think old Dave Chipman, after he couldn't get become head of the ATF, I think he's gone back to Every Town to lobby against taking away guns. Anyway, so that's where they are on guns. And in California, they are going to start collecting information. Earlier, I read a comment from a listener who said, by the way, CMS is getting all kinds of information from people's medical records, and they're sharing it with an undisclosed third party, violating our medical privacy, and we know why that is. It's a big part of the tyranny that is rolling out. California is now going to take information that's been collecting from gun owners, all kinds of stuff, and they're going to give that to researchers who are researching violence prevention. How do you think that's going to be used? It's going to be red flag research. They say they're not going to tie it to any particular individuals, but you know that when they give this to academics, and this law has been signed into, this has been signed into law by Governor Newsom, when they give it to these various academic institutions that are very hostile to anybody other than the police owning a gun, they're going to use this, and they're going to play their numbers game. Yeah, I got a couple of cases here, a couple of cases of ammunition for gun control. Whether or not the resultant research, writes Reason Magazine, has published names or a specific person, because they say, yeah, we're not going to identify specific individuals, that doesn't really matter. What they're going to do is they're going to correlate this. They're going to use this to produce numbers and science and cases to push for gun control. You know, that's where this is all headed. California gun owners have long had reason to be suspicious of the amount of information about gun purchases that the state of California insists on collecting and saving. These have, after all, led to literal attempts of confiscation of certain once legal, but not now legal weapons. Supreme Court next week will be hearing some gun cases as well as some abortion cases. They begin their new term next week, and we've had a lot of statements by both Alito and Barrett recently saying, we are not a political organization. Thomas also was saying that, Clarence Thomas. And one person commented that, well, whenever the court is saying that it's not a political institution, that's a pretty good indication that there's a large number of people who think that it is. I'm one of those people. I think it's a political organization. I don't think that they objectively look at the law. I think the appropriate response for somebody like Clarence Thomas, I think he does look at the law for the most part. I don't agree with every decision that he has, but for the most part, he tries to base it on the law, I think. What they ought to say is, I'd prefer for them to be honest and say, well, it shouldn't be political, but in reality it is. Because the judges that identify with the left, they don't believe that there is an objective standard. They talk about the fact that they think the Constitution is a living document. No, it's a dead piece of paper. And you're the one who is in charge of enforcing it. The paper, if you leave the paper alone, you may have noticed that the words don't start to reorganize themselves. That requires your input. The paper, the words just stay where they are. And I don't need a judge to interpret some things that are pretty plain in the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights is very plain. I mean, you can argue about some of the legal details of the body of the Constitution, but the Bill of Rights is very, very plain. Everybody can understand. If you speak English, I don't need an interpreter. David Hogg is trying to reinterpret it. David Hogg came out and said the Second Amendment is a collective right. Let me say this to David Hogg and anybody else, there is no such thing as a collective right. There are individual rights, and there are collective or government powers. Whenever people started talking about states' rights and states' rights, I know that's a very common thing. around the Civil War, and a lot of people will talk about that today. States do not have rights. People who were created in the image of God are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. The state is not created in the image of God. Now, the state is ultimately created by God, but it's not created in the image of God. It does not have rights. The Bill of Rights, the first eight sections of the Bill of Rights are about things that people can do that government should not interfere with. Or in the case of things like due process and being allowed to confront your accusers and everything, those are all individual rights. I say this all the time about public health. If you're going to say that the individual is going to be subsumed to this nebulous thing called public health, but we don't respect the health of any individuals. It doesn't matter what your medical conditions are, we're not going to recognize them. It doesn't matter what your religious beliefs are, we're not going to recognize them. You will take this injection. If that's your position, there is no such thing as public health. That is something that is just a tool for power. It's an imaginary construct by these people who want to be dictators because they say, well, I'm the person who says what's best for the public health. I know this isn't in your interest, and it's not in your interest, and it's not in your interest. And as every individual comes up and says, wait a minute, this policy is going to hurt my health. I don't care. I'm doing this for the collective. And so the Second Amendment is not a collective right. Free speech is not a collective right. It's an individual right. Each individual has the right to speak. And so there is no such thing as that. You have even the states have powers. And the people collectively in the Tenth Amendment have powers as a collection. In New York, the Attorney General says it's easier in some places to find a gun than it is to find an apple in the Big Apple. Well, this is testimony to the effectiveness of a free market. That's right. You know, whenever you have a black market that has been created by prohibition of some product, that is a free market. And it may be ironic, but when you stop and think about it, black markets of prohibited products are the freest markets that we have. They are the most unregulated markets. Because until you swoop in and grab everybody in the market and arrest them, it is a totally free market. It is free of any regulation. It is free of any safety regulations or anything else. And so in a black market, you'll always find that there is an abundance of whatever it is that you want to prohibit, whether that is drugs or whether it is guns. Even when you talk about they tried to more or less prohibit tobacco by putting very, very high taxes on it in New York. So the black market, the free market, decided, well, instead of us bringing in a lot of cigarettes and selling them by the box, the taxes have gotten so high. Karen had some from some family who smoked, and they were kind of on the border between New York and some other states. They would go to another state to buy the taxes because to buy the cigarettes because the taxes were so high. And so you had the situation, as a matter of fact, was it Eric Garner? Was that the guy that was choked out in New York? Yeah, Eric Garner. He was selling Lucy's. He was selling individual cigarettes. So you go to New Jersey, for example, and buy a box of, or case of cigarettes, and he would sell them one at a time on the street, and they would sell them without the taxes at all. And that's what happens when the government gets too greedy and it puts the taxes up too high. You wind up driving people to another place to buy them, or you wind up having somebody selling them individually on the streets without any taxes at all to the New York State. But a black market creates a lot of corruption. A black market creates a lot of violence and crime. But it is a free market, and whatever they are selling, whether it is drugs or guns, you're going to have an abundance of that stuff, because one way or the other, people are going to find what they want in a free market. And you will also have a rapid improvement in those products, if you could call it that. One of the problems with the war on drugs of Richard Nixon, which turned 50 this last June, 50 years of this, hasn't stopped the use of drugs at all, but what it has done is given us much more concentrated forms of these drugs. I don't think that's a good thing. I don't think that any drug use is good for people, but I also don't think that prohibition is a good thing. It's got a lot of negative effects, and it doesn't stop anything. And so you have the same thing that happened with alcohol. They never stopped alcohol. You got more concentrated forms of it. You got a lot more corruption in government, and you had a lot of violence on the streets as people were shooting each other. So the fact that it is easier to find a gun in New York than it is to find an apple, well, that all has to do with a free market. Shooting in China shows how gun control doesn't work even in communist China any more than it works in communist New York. They had a picture of a guy who goes in with a gun and shoots his shoots a lawyer who he was not happy with. So video clips circulating online show the gunman leaving the office with what appears to be a shotgun and then pointing it at motorists. That makes me think, Travis, of when we were in China. We were in a street of shops, and if you've never been to China, you don't realize just how many people there are. I mean, it was like I was in New York on St. Patrick's Day one time, and the crowd was just amazing. You could not move, and that's the way it was on a typical day shopping in this area in China. You couldn't move. There were so many people. And in the middle of that, this armored car pulls up, and we could see these guys through the glass, and they're holding shotguns. And then the doors open up, and this guy, you know, security guard, gets out, and he's got a shotgun, and he's not holding it up with the barrel up. He levels the gun at the crowd. And I said to the family, let's get out of here. There's look at that, to the sea of people. And he gets out, and he just levels the gun, and it's like, man, if he goes off on this thing, he's going to be hitting a lot of people with a shotgun. And the way everybody was packed in there, I said, let's just get out of here. It was insane. But, yeah, so in China, the guy gets out and he's got a gun. They don't stop that. One last thing here about guns and ammunition. This is an interesting story about what's happened to ammunition prices over the last year as we go through this pandemic. The rise and fall of 9mm ammo prices during COVID. They said, weirdly enough, the price of ammo, this is on Zero Hedge, the price of ammo didn't have an immediate rise at the beginning of the pandemic. It was about 20 cents a round until July, and then we started to see an increase up to about 30 cents a round. That could be attributed to the BLM protests and the fact that people saw that innocent people were getting hurt, that the police weren't doing anything in many of these jurisdictions. So prices started to go up, and by August, it went up to 50 cents per round. For 9mm. About 20 cents a round, goes up to 30 cents a round because a little bit of shortage because of the pandemic stuff, and then when the BLM stuff happens, it goes up to 50 cents a round. But then, because of the lockdown and that issue, you started to get a shortage of primer. As they point out, primers are the component within the ammunition that ignites the gunpowder to expel the projectile, the bullet. For those who don't know, primers are incredibly dangerous to produce. And they're typically the bottleneck in the production process for ammunition. A shortage of primers caused a high demand, and supply chain disruption continued to help drive up the cost of ammunition. And so by the election, it was up to 60 cents per pound. Remember, as the pandemic was starting, it was 20 cents, not pound, round. It was 20 cents a round at the beginning of the pandemic. And then by January, 9mm prices on average hit 71 cents per round, and then at that time you were seeing a lot that were out there for $1 a round, so five times. They said, as of this writing in September, we're now starting to see a drop in ammunition prices, and gun sales are starting to slow down a little bit. 9mm is now sitting at 31 cents per round for steel cases, 34 cents per round for brass on the low end. Any well-known brand names are sitting about 39 cents per round. Even with Biden's new Russian ammunition ban, prices seem to have steadily fallen, at least on 9mm. And they said there's a lot of different factors that could influence the market right now. They said there's a coup in Guinea that has sent aluminum prices to a 10-year high. If you're unfamiliar, Guinea holds a quarter of the world's bauxite supply, a raw material that can be used and refined into alumina, which can then be smelted into aluminum, or if you are in the UK, aluminium. But, it's kind of like iPencil, isn't it? There's a lot of different things that, you know, again, most of the aluminum is, a lot of it is coming from Guinea, and if there's a coup there, that takes the price up. Leonard Reed's editorial about iPencil, where he talks about, yeah, we've got to get the rubber over here, and we get this part over there, and the wood comes from that. And so I guess this is iBullet. We could do a whole, we could do an update. That'd be kind of interesting, doing an update on Leonard Reed's iPencil and call it iBullet. Mo Green, right in the eye. Anyway, seeing this in gun sales right now, where customers aren't coming in and just buying anything on the wall, they're not doing that. They're starting to pick around. So it looks like things are starting to ease up a little bit with that. Since I'm getting close on time, let me just jump into the toxic medication real quickly and point out that you're starting to see even a Drudge Report. Oh, look at this. Lockdown Melbourne is having cases hit a big record despite 2 months of lockdown. Why is that happening? Well, because they're leaning on people so heavily with these vaccine mandates, that is having an effect, and some people are getting the vaccine shots that did not get it before. And every time you start giving people vaccines, whether it's because you are hitting them over the head with a hammer, threatening to take away their entire life, or whether this is because they're in a third world country where they hadn't had access to vaccines, fortunately for them, as soon as you bring that in, you start to see an explosion in people getting sick and dying. Isn't that interesting? So it's happening in Melbourne, in Maine. The Wall Street Journal points out that well-vaccinated Maine, COVID-19 is still filling hospitals. Ah, but they say it's with the unvaccinated. Ah, but we know that their definition of the unvaccinated is anybody who is, even if you've had one shot, even if it's been 30 days, you're not counted as vaccinated until you get that second shot, and it's 2 weeks past that. And we're seeing a lot of people who are getting sick and dying after just the first shot. However, somebody who's gotten both of his, fully vaxxed former CNN contributor Mark Lamont Hill, has suffered a heart attack and is hospitalized with blood clots, but he blames players who are critical of the vaccine. It doesn't matter how common heart attacks become. It doesn't matter how common these formerly very rare blood clot situations become. Oh, no. The problem is the unvaccinated people. The problem is not big pharmaceutical companies. The problem isn't a government that not only skipped the testing but demanded that the testing be skipped. No, the problem is you. You are the problem. COVID-19 vaccines are increasing deaths and hospitalizations around the world. This is a story that you should read on vaccine impact. Dr. Gerard Delapine from France has just finished a study based on public data from the countries with the highest vaccination rates, and it clearly shows the COVID-19 shots are hospitalizing people and killing people at higher rates than countries who have adopted early treatment protocols without the use of vaccines. There was also another epidemiological study that came out of France that was about 40 or 50 different countries in every area of the world. Europe, Africa, Latin America, the Middle East, Asia, all these different places, North America, all these different places, but especially in places, for example, like Mongolia, where they didn't have access to the vaccines at all in the beginning. They could look at it, and they could see that in some places, like in India, regional areas, there might be sometimes a rise in people getting sick, and then they start ivermectin, and it drops down to zero. And then you go a few months down the road, and instead of getting a gentle curve that goes up, you get a straight-up spike when they start the vaccines. Straight up. Country after country, where they did not have access to the vaccines, where they didn't have access to the expensive pharmaceutical medications that are patented, like remdesivir, that don't do anything. They do have their harmful effects, but they don't have any positive effects. So the people who didn't have access to these expensive drugs that they're stealing money from us, as well as harming us, as soon as they got access to these drugs, because they were given grants or Bill Gates wanted them to have a little bit, wanted to share the population reduction with them, as soon as that happened, you could see them going straight up. And so that was another epidemiologist, because that was a woman from France. This is Gerard from France. Anyway, a video of a well-known Trinidad pastor has gone viral this week as she mourns the death of her son just hours after he took the shot. She's crying, and you can hear someone in the background mourning and wailing. But if you look at Gibraltar, for example, 34,000 inhabitants. They started vaccination in December 2020 when the health agency counted only 1,000 confirmed cases and 5 deaths. After a very comprehensive vaccination blitz, they achieved 115% coverage. What? 115%? Yeah, they got everyone in Gibraltar plus a lot of Spanish visitors. That's how they got more than 115,000. I showed you pictures earlier this week in Romania. They were pushing the vaccine to tourists when they still had tourism there a little bit at Dracula's Castle. Yeah, we got some blood-sucking freaks here. Pushing vaccines on people. They were actually trying to tie it in with Dracula. It didn't work too well. That somehow gave people a bad... you might go to Frankenstein's Castle and start trying to convince them on the efficacy of your mRNA vaccine as well. But they were able to get 115% coverage in Gibraltar by getting Spanish visitors as well. What happened? Well, they had the number of new infections went up by a factor of 5 times as many new cases, and they had the number of deaths increased by a factor of 20. Think about that. I mean, it's not just people testing positive or getting sick. That went up by a factor of 5, but the number of deaths went up by a factor of 19, nearly 20 times as much. In Malta, with 84% vaccine coverage, they said one of the champions of the Trump shots, an island of 500,000 inhabitants, nearly 800,000 doses have been administered, ensuring a vaccine coverage of nearly 84% with a delay of about 6 months. But in the beginning of July 2021, the epidemic has started again, and the serious and fatal forms are increasing and forcing the authorities to recognize that vaccination does not protect the population and to impose restrictions. In Iceland, the people no longer believe in herd immunity. In this small country of 360,000 inhabitants, more than 80% are vaccinated with one, and 75% have gotten two, which we're now saying is complete for the moment until Pfizer decides that they want to make some more money in Moderna. But by mid-July 2021, new daily infections had risen from about 10 to 120, 12 times higher than the pre-vaccination rate. And so they said, well, it doesn't look like it's going to even be possible to get collective immunity through vaccination. Chief epidemiologist said that was herd immunity was a myth, he said. Herd immunity was a lie. Herd immunity was a deception tactic. Herd immunity was always a malleable number. And herd immunity, when it first came up, was not a lie. Herd immunity was, as I've said many times, just another expression that was done in the early part of the 20th century, another expression of the curve, Farr's Law, that was done in 1840. And you can have herd immunity when, you know, you stop the passage of it as people who are exposed to it and have natural immunity. As they encounter a pathogen, their body takes care of it and doesn't and destroys it so that it's not passed on. That's the idea. Problem is, these vaccines are not doing that. They're not providing immunity at the very beginning, and they're not providing any lasting immunity. And they are making people sick. This is not the Delta variant. And I'll tell you why. Take a look at this, for example. That's what they want to do. There's two things. First of all, they came up with a Delta variant excuse, the Delta farce. And they have to get everybody 100% vaccinated because we are the control group and we'll show that this whole thing is a farce. The Delta variant lie is not going to work if they don't get everybody vaccinated. If you get everybody vaccinated and everybody is getting sick and everybody is getting heart attacks and blood clots and so forth, you can say, well, it just must be the variant. But if you've got a lot of people who are not vaccinated, they can't blame it on that. And look at what is happening in Israel. 70% of the population has a single shot. Nearly 90% of those at risk have a complete vaccination cycle, but the epidemic has rebounded stronger than ever since the end of June. More than 11,000 cases were recorded in a single day after they got massive vaccination. They were the most vaccinated large country anywhere. They said by the end of July, 71% of the 118 seriously ill Israelis, seriously and critically ill, were fully vaccinated. And they said, if you understand, this is much higher than the proportion of fully vaccinated people. So they have fully vaccinated people are 61%, but 71% of the seriously ill are fully vaccinated. What does that tell you? Well, it tells you that it is a farce. And as all of this is happening in Australia, they're saying no jab, no pay. They are bragging about the fact that they are not going to allow people, even after they reach their magic number, their magic arbitrary number of 70%, they're not going to let unvaccinated people participate in the economy. And they're saying now, instead of no jab, no job, they're saying no jab, no pay. We've seen this in Italy as well. I think what this is about, in my opinion, what they're doing with this no jab, no pay policy, it's just a way to keep people from getting unemployment. They're saying, well, you can still come to work, I'm just not going to pay you. Oh, you don't want to come to work? Okay, well, then you quit, and I don't pay you any unemployment. But, of course, Biden has just said the people that he fires that works for the federal government, he's not going to give them any unemployment anyway. He's going to consider the same. But I think when we look at this, and this is happening now in Australia for all the different states. You know, we've talked in the past about Gladys Berejiklian in New South Wales. We've talked about Dictator Dan Android, who is in in Victoria, where Melbourne is. But this is Scott Morrison, and he's going to do this nationally. He's going to say, well, we're going to force people to get vaccinated. If they don't get vaccinated, they can still come to work, but they're not going to get paid. It's one of the most cynical, tyrannical, destructive things that I have seen with any of this stuff. One person who talking about herd immunity, this is a letter sent to me by Michael B. He said that perhaps herd immunity should be renamed herd tyranny, since it's obvious that our medical overlords never want their power grab to end. Oh, yeah, that's exactly what it is. It is a herd tyranny, and it is based on a herd mentality of people who have been gaslighted. And I guess we could say, is it psychogenic or psychosomatic? No, it is flat out psycho war. I had someone ask me, I'd referred to this many times, and I think many times I'd said that it was a study from 2002. The actual article might have been from 2002, but the actual article was 2003. It's from the Sydney Morning Herald. The person said, you've mentioned many times that there was a study, a mask study, that said that they're only safe for 20 minutes. That's right. This is a story from April 27th, 2003, in case you want to find it. The Sydney Morning Herald, right there in Australia, right there, New South Wales. The Fair Trading Minister at the time, Reba Meagher, warned that distributors and traders could be prosecuted if they suggested that the masks, and again, this is because people were worried about SARS back in 2003. So you saw people in Asia start to wear these masks. And this person who is in charge of fair trading, which here we would say the Federal Trade Commission or something like that, said, if you're offering these masks to people for protection, we're going to come after you for fraud. And you could get fines up to $110,000. They said there appears to be some debate as to whether or not surgical masks are able to minimize the effects of SARS. Well, she said they can't. And the article was farce mask. Farce mask. Maybe we should have... We should have a t-shirt show somebody with a face mask on and say above it, may the farce be with you. Maybe that's the way that we greet each other in the public square. Who knows? Maybe they'll think we're being polite. Those masks are only effective as long as they are dry, said Professor Yvonne Cossert of the Department of Infectious Diseases at the University of Sydney in 2003 before we had the lies being sold to us by Fauci to push the vaccine for no reason whatsoever. As soon as they become saturated with moisture in your breath, they stop doing their job and they pass on the droplets. The professor said that takes as little as 15 or 20 minutes, after which these N95 masks would need to be changed. This is a very important study. This was done at a time when we really did science, we really did have research, and we had integrity. Now it's nothing other than lies. Everybody, as you point out to them, these particles are so small they're going to go right through these N95, not even close. Oh, well, it's about the droplets. Well, same thing after 20 minutes. That's it for the broadcast. Thank you for listening. Have a great weekend. Common Man. They created Common Core to dumb down our children. They created Common Pass to track and control us. Their Commons Project to make sure the commoners own nothing. And the communist future. They see the common man as simple, unsophisticated, ordinary. But each of us has worth and dignity created in the image of God. That is what we have in common. That is what they want to take away. Their most powerful weapons are isolation, deception, intimidation. They desire to know everything about us while they hide everything from us. It's time to turn that around and expose what they want to hide. Please share the information and links you'll find at thedavidknightshow.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. If you can't support us financially, please keep us in your prayers. TheDavidKnightShow.com.